Welcome back to Monday Night Raw, the longest running weekly episodic show ever in the history of television. And boy, do we have a treat for all of you. We have secured the first exclusive interview with our very own WWE superstar, Roman Reigns. That's right, I said exclusive. We scooped all the major media outlets for this one, CNN, Fox News, Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight, TMZ, People Magazine, The People's Court, Mean Gene's Event Center, WWE.com, even SEScoops.com, and they have the word scoops in their name. So, Roman, we've been promoting this interview all week long. Tell us, how are you feeling?
Things are doing a lot better. The doctors are happy with my progression.
Thank you, Roman, for that insightful interview. We now return to our usual programming of bad comedy and shitty celebrity guests. And The Rock. The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 349 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 12th, 2014. I am the Sala Monster. Thank you to everybody for all the birthday wishes this past week. It was quite overwhelming, so big thank you for that. Also, I want to acknowledge the reaction from many of you to my words at the end of last week's show. It really struck a chord. I didn't think it would get the kind of response that it did. Lots of you shared stories with me of your own health situations, things that you've been through, your family members, when I talked about my mom last week. So I just want to say thank you for that, because that was completely unexpected. I didn't expect that kind of reaction. And so you know, if you heard the end of the show last week, you'll know what I'm talking about here. Dr. Cook did end up hearing that part of the podcast. So I thought that was pretty cool. If you want to show your support for the Sound Off, you can do so in a variety of different ways. The best thing you can do is listen to the podcast every single week through iTunes, Stitcher Radio. We're on TuneIn Radio as well. We have a free app in the Google Play Store for those of you with Android devices. But keep streaming us on Stitcher and that sort of thing, because that helps out the podcast. And also, you can sign up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service using our custom URL. That's audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. We've been doing very well all year long. If you remember, we started this back in January. I've been bringing you this offer since the beginning of the year. We're closing in now on the end of the year, and we're doing pretty well. We could be doing even better. So the more people who sign up for the Audible trial, try out the service, sample it. You're only helping the podcast by doing so. You get free 30 days worth of Audible service and one free audio book that you get to keep whether you stick with it or not. audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Use that link, sign up for the free trial, get your free audio book, and you'll thank me later. I think you'll enjoy it. Also, have a bunch of PayPal shout-outs for people who have donated to the show. You can do so on thesalamonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. My thanks to the all-night player, Aniket Sawant, the reflection of perfection, Abraham Lara, Adam the Maniac Misaglia, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Zach House of Pain Holker, Demolition Man Donovan McIntosh, Delirious Damian T. Robinson, Tori, All I Do Is Win Johansson, Jonathan Grandmaster Grunwald, Ray Big Dog Blick, Jake the Snake Brand, Sinister Joe Meyer, Deadly Jordan Dalzell, High Society, Thurman Taylor the Fourth, and the tag team, our second tag team, so I guess our tag division now rivals NXT's, of Oliver Davis and Daniel White, the Android Destroyers. And you might ask yourself, why the Android Destroyers? Because it sounds frickin' cool. That's why. And that's what we need in wrestling, more cool tag team names. And by the way, shout out to Daniel, who has his first child on the way, a future Sound Off listener, no doubt. Congrats to him. You can make a PayPal donation again on thesalamonster.com if you so choose. And also, don't forget, we have a store on prowrestlingtees.com. We have a brand new shirt up, a property of the Sound Off workout t-shirt right now, sport gray. That's up in the store, prowrestlingtees.com/salamonstersoundsoff. And keep an eye out, because in the next few days, probably by the time you even listen to this, there will be two more shirts up in the store. And these are the two shirts I've been waiting several weeks to get up. Kind of old school throwback. I think you'll know what I'm talking about when you see them. I'm excited to get them up. So definitely head over to the store this week on Pro Wrestling Tees. which now accepts payment by credit or debit card. I know that's a big thing I wanted to bring up here because I know some of you guys have an aversion to PayPal, or don't have an account, or can't sign up for an account, whatever the reason may be. Now you can actually buy a shirt whether you have PayPal or not. You can do it that way, or you can do it by credit card or debit card. That's now being accepted by Pro Wrestling Tees, so you have no excuse. Head over to the store, check out what we got, and pick up a shirt. I want to lead off here this week by talking a little bit about the 15th anniversary of SmackDown, which they aired a special show Friday night, as many of you know. I watched most of the show by now, at least the important stuff. It was a show. You know, they had a big 15-man tag team match. I'm not done watching that. I don't know if I'll finish it or not. I'm sure it was a great match, but, you know, you see so many tag team matches on WWE television week to week, and six-man tags, eight-man tags. After a while, you know, you get numb to the whole thing. So I'm sure it was a fine match. I was more interested in seeing the Triple H Rock confrontation, in seeing what was going down with Teddy Long and Big Johnny brought back former SmackDown GMs in the ring with Stephanie McMahon in the opening segment. That was entertaining enough until Adam Rose came out, and then not so much. But the Rock Triple H thing, I want to talk about that and a little bit more about SmackDown here. I like the Rock Triple H segment. I know some people did not. Most people, it seems like, they enjoyed it for what it was. I enjoyed it for what it was. It was just a nice moment between two guys who were a big part of the fabric of SmackDown back in the day, a big part of the Attitude Era when that show came on the air. And they certainly teased you and led you to believe that there may well be a match between the two of them at WrestleMania 31 next year. It could very well just be, you know, a comedy tease for the sake of just doing, you know, comedy, and there's actually no plans for a match. But between that and between the segment that Triple H did on WWE.com, his weekly sit-down with Michael Cole, he was still harping on The Rock. I think there's at least a shot. There's at least a chance that they could do Rock, Triple H, or WrestleMania next year. I'm pretty sure I've talked about that possibility on the podcast before. I don't mind that at all. I would be okay with that. That's one match that, you know, Rock is part-time, and people always complain, well, he's coming back to take a spot from somebody else, or who's he going to work with? Who's he going to squash? Or, you know, all this nonsense. Yeah, to me, if you have a match on the WrestleMania card between two guys, two part-time guys, two old-school guys rekindling a feud, they occupy one slot on the show, they're not wrestling a younger guy or anything like that, then I have no problem with it. It's not offensive to me at all. They have their own spot on the show. The other guys, the young guys, are doing their thing, and it's a nice stroll down memory lane. Look, they had one of the all-time classic rivalries in the Attitude Era. Maybe one of the all-time classic rivalries in WWE history. I won't put it at number one, but it's way up there. I thought they had a lot of great matches, a lot of good matches back in the day. Their careers, in a lot of ways, paralleled one another as well. I mean, Triple H was in WWE first. Rock came in a little bit later on. But if you look at the progression of each of them, you know, Rock beat Triple H to win his first championship, his Intercontinental title back in 97. And you had to know that there was at least some jealousy there. I mean, Triple H, here's a guy who was there first, busting his ass. The stuff went down with the curtain call at Madison Square Garden. He took the heat for it, probably unfairly so. Here comes this new kid, right? He looks good, except the hair. The hair was horrendous. But here's this kid coming in, second-generation athlete, actually third-generation athlete. And they're pushing him to the moon within 2 or 3 months of him making his debut. And clearly The Rock, when he first came in, was still very green. He was not ready to have the spotlight put on him the way that he did. And the fans reacted the way that you would expect them to. The fans, there was a huge backlash. You know, die, Rocky, die. They knew it was too much too soon, so they turned on him, which worked to his advantage in the end. He went away with a knee injury, came back, turned heel. And after that, you know, he was in his comfort zone. It was off to the races. But you look at their two careers. Rock made it quicker than Triple H did. I'm sure there was a lot of resentment there, a lot of jealousy. But then they all the matches they had for the WWE Championship, for the Intercontinental Championship, the cage matches, the ladder match at SummerSlam, the strap match on one of those pay-per-views. They never had that one big singles match at WrestleMania, which I think is a crime. I mean, that's a match one-on-one that should have happened at WrestleMania 2000. Instead, they turned it into this fatal four-way match with Big Show, who, if I remember correctly, was eliminated within the first 5 minutes of the match. And they had Mick Foley out there, who was in no shape to even be in the match. He had retired. He thought he was done. He lost a retirement match to Triple H a month before, and then plans change. They call him back. They probably wave a bunch of money in his face. All of a sudden, Mick Foley is back wearing a flannel shirt, doing an elbow drop off the top rope and missing the announce desk. That was embarrassing. So ultimately, it came down to Rock, Triple H in that match. They wrestled the bulk of it, but it wasn't, you know, that wasn't what it should have been. And they ended up doing the match the month after when Austin was there. And, you know, it was a great moment when Rock finally won the belt, but they never had that one big moment one-on-one at a WrestleMania. So at least in that way, if they did the match, that could be part of the story. Here are these two guys, the wars they had. We never went one-on-one at a WrestleMania. Who would win? You know, I can dig that. I can get into that story. And I thought the interplay between them was funny. They were all cordial at first, and you knew it was all phony. And then Triple H said, well, you know, if you and I ever did wrestle at a WrestleMania, it would be no different than our past battles. I'd whip your ass. And Rock took exception to that. Then they did some comedy. That's actually how the segment ended. Stephanie came in. She broke it up. She said, listen, both of you are great. Can we please go get some food? And off they went to go have dinner. So I enjoyed it. You know, I can't knock it. It was fun. It was a nice little 5 or 6 minutes of nostalgia. And like I said, if it leads to a WrestleMania match, if there's any chance of that happening, I'm okay with that. And yeah, just to reflect back on SmackDown itself, 15 years this show has been on the air. They're billing it as the second longest running weekly episodic television show in history, which I'm sure is complete bullshit if you actually investigated that. But that's their claim. And it's impressive, you know, it's very impressive that SmackDown has been on the air as long as it has with Raw. They have these two shows that have been on the air for so long. And, you know, when SmackDown made its debut back in 99, wrestling was never as hotter as it was during that period. It was white hot. And they had the pilot episode, if you remember, that aired in April of 99, which was just taped, I think, one night after an episode of Raw. It was in the Raw arena. You know, it didn't look that unique. It was a test run to see how the show would do on UPN. I guess it did well enough. And then in August, they brought the show back full-time. They gave it a full-time run on UPN. So wrestling was back on network television. And they had its own unique look, the little oval Titantron. And, you know, it had its own unique set. And that's one of the things I think that's missing about a lot of the TV shows and the pay-per-views now. Nothing is unique. WrestleMania is the only thing that's unique. Everything else looks the same. They have that set that they paid tens of millions of dollars for, that HD set that can morph, you know, into whatever they want it to be, and they could put little advertisements up there for the next pay-per-view, and they have all the LED lights. I'm sure it's, you know, Kevin Dunn and the production team's wet dream to have something like that. The problem is, it just looks the same. Raw and SmackDown have the same set, and with the budget cuts now, all the pay-per-views, practically, except for WrestleMania, have virtually the same set. So there's no uniqueness to anything. Back then, everything was unique. Every pay-per-view had its own set. Remember the Backlash set with those hooks that would go back and forth? WrestleMania obviously had its own set. Even Raw and SmackDown had their own sets. Now Raw, SmackDown, Superstars, Main Event, it's all the same shit. So it was a unique thing back then. Wrestling was hot, and there was a thirst for more wrestling. People weren't complaining, oh my God, we have more wrestling. No, they were ready for it. They wanted to see Stone Cold and The Rock and Triple H and The Undertaker and Chris Jericho on Thursday nights. SmackDown was the hot ticket back then. But over time, wrestling waned in popularity. We see where things are now compared to 1999. Wrestling is cold as a cadaver now, if you want to compare it to that time period. And yet we have more hours of television for WWE now than we did back then. They have more television now as a cold product compared to the way it was in 1999. And people wonder, they ask me, how come you don't watch SmackDown? How come you don't review SmackDown every week? There's no need for it. That's the thing. You could argue there was no need for it back then either. It only watered down the product that much more. But because the product was so hot and the ratings were so high, I mean, Raw was doing ratings in the sixes and sevens every single week. So if they can get two more hours of television on network television, on network TV, and maybe broaden their audience a little bit more, then why not? They would have been foolish not to do it. And Thursday night, especially back then, Thursday night was a great night, still is a great night for television. Friday nights, to this day, I still don't understand why they accepted a move to Friday nights. I assume it was whatever network they were on at the time, which I guess would have been my network, just slotted them there. Maybe they had no say in the matter. Friday night is not a good night for television. And compared to Thursday night, there is no comparison. They never should have moved from Thursdays in the first place. And it's funny because now, you know, there were rumors a couple of months ago that SmackDown would be moving to Thursdays back in their old slot. And then nothing happened. Remember the ads that leaked on the trucks and all that kind of stuff? And then Sci-Fi shook up their fall lineup. SmackDown was going to debut on October 2nd on Thursday nights, and then plans changed. Well, now it appears that SmackDown probably is moving, after all, to Thursday, starting in mid-January. Although the night of the week is not confirmed. We don't know for a fact that it'll be Thursdays, but it's definitely moving as of mid-January. I guess Sci-Fi maybe just didn't want them getting slaughtered by football. You know, that's one of the reasons Spike moved Impact from Thursdays to Wednesdays. Can you imagine if Impact was still airing on Thursdays against some of these football games? I mean, it would be an absolute slaughter. So that's why they moved Impact, and I'm just guessing here that maybe that's why they delayed the move for WWE. They want to wait until football season plays itself out, and then SmackDown, it looks like, will be back in its old time slot. And I think it's a good move. I think it's a good move for them. It's not going to change my viewing habits at all, so it's not as though I'm going to start watching SmackDown every single week. I'm going to start reviewing the show. If there's a reason to do so one particular week, I will, but it's not changing my viewing habits at all. It doesn't change the fact there is still way too much television right now for WWE that's out there, and I'm not even counting the network. There is way too much WWE on television as it is, and with the current product as it is, I mean, one show is probably more than enough, let alone three or four different shows every single week. And let's be honest here, 3 hours of Raw is plenty for me, especially since they just repeat the same matches on Friday night anyway. Or the matches they do on Friday night, we end up seeing rematches on Monday night. And vice versa, we go back and forth with this every single week, except for the colors. You know, you think Raw red, SmackDown blue, Raw Monday, SmackDown Friday. There's not much else that's different about the two shows. You might get some more wrestling, some more quality wrestling on Fridays. Actually, the biggest difference, I guess, is that SmackDown's only 2 hours, which maybe I should start watching SmackDown and ditching Raw. Maybe that's what I have to start doing. But I sure as hell am not going to watch both shows every single week. There's really no need for SmackDown anymore. It is a completely unnecessary, useless show. But the more TV you can get, the more money you can make, so they do it. I'm sure if they could have television on every single night of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they would do it. God help us all if that ever happens. I mean, as it is, we have wrestling on television every single night of the week anyway. We have Raw Mondays. We have Main Event on Tuesdays, if you want to count that. We have Impact, which is now on Wednesdays. It looks like SmackDown will be moving to Thursdays, which is also when NXT drops. So maybe Friday now will be the odd night out. And then you have the pay-per-views sometimes on the weekend. So, I mean, there's just way too much. There's way too much wrestling at a time when wrestling just isn't that good. You give me good wrestling, you give me good stuff, good storylines, good characters, some fun stuff, great. I'll pick and choose what I want to watch. Maybe I'll watch it all. You shovel shit down our throat every single week. I'm not gonna sit here and waste my time. Life's too short. So that's the problem with SmackDown today in 2014. Back in 1999, you know, the product, things were a lot different. And I think back over SmackDown's run the last 15 years, especially back when I used to watch SmackDown every single week, and I think of some of the, like, my favorite SmackDown matches and moments, and things that jump out at me. I think one of the all-time great SmackDown moments had to be the ring collapse back in 2003 with Brock Lesnar and The Big Show. I know they recreated that with Mark Henry and The Big Show a few years ago. It wasn't quite the same. I remember the first time I saw that, my jaw dropped. The whole building, it was a great moment. I mean, people weren't expecting it. It was something they had never seen before. Whoever came up with the idea for that as a gimmick that night really should have gotten a raise. It was just this great visual, as ridiculous as it was, that, you know, a simple superplex off the top apparently rendered both men unable to stand up on their own two feet. They had to bring in doctors and an ambulance. I mean, that was kind of ridiculous. But I think people were still so overwhelmed by the stunt itself, they didn't really pay any attention to that. But it was a great moment, a great visual. I think back to the Brock Lesnar-Kurt Angle 60-minute Iron Man match on SmackDown. I think back to, I think TLC 3 took place. That's one of the often forgotten TLC matches that had Edge and Christian, the Hardys, the Dudleys, and Chris Benoit and Chris Jericho, which I think was the night after they won the belts from Austin and Triple H. Triple H got hurt with an injury, so I think plans changed. I don't think the original plan was for them to to do a TLC match on television. I remember Jericho telling the story where they found out when they got to the building, hey, you guys are going to be in a TLC match tonight. It's like, oh, okay. But they went out there and they had a hell of a match, and it's not a match you're going to see on WWE television, given who's involved, unfortunately. But it was a great match. You know, look, if I really think back, I'm sure I could pick out other matches and moments, but SmackDown, you know, at times, you look back when Paul Heyman had the book, and they had the SmackDown 6, and every single week we were getting matches with guys like Los Guerreros and Edge and Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle, and they had some big names on that show. The Rock, when he was Hollywood Rock, was a SmackDown guy, Hulk Hogan for a time. There was a period there, and if you go back, it was during Triple H's Reign of Terror with the world title on Raw, so we're looking at that 2002 to 2004 period where SmackDown, in my opinion, was the A show. There was no debate about it. It was the more wrestling-heavy show. And even the non-wrestling stuff, comedy and some of the other storylines, to me was just more appealing than what was going on Raw. It was the Triple H show every single week. And it was one of the low points in the history of Monday Night Raw. So you throw in a guy like Paul Heyman, who I think that was around the time he was writing the show, and it was just... SmackDown has never gotten back to that level. It has never been as good as it was during those years in the early to mid-2000s, and that's a shame because SmackDown is still around all these years later, and look, there may be plenty of good wrestling on this show. I hear from you guys all the time, oh, you got to see this match. They gave these guys 12 minutes, 15 minutes. Cesaro and Dolph went out there, and they tore the house down, and that's all well and good, but I'm fatigued because they may have gone out there on SmackDown, Cesaro and Dolph, and had this great match. But then you look at what they're doing with them on Monday nights, which, let's be honest, that's all that really matters. And you just shake your head, like, what's the point? That's when you realize that SmackDown has become a truly useless show. And that's how I see it. So 15 years of SmackDown, it's a great milestone. But to me, when you really look at what the show was and where the show is today in terms of its value, I wouldn't be so happy if I was WWE. To me, there's nothing to be happy about. You've coasted the last few years. You still have the show on the air. That's a great milestone. That's something to be celebrated. But I wouldn't be celebrating too hard when you really look at the state of SmackDown and the usefulness of SmackDown these days. All it is a rehash of things we saw on Monday night. And what's there to be excited about if that's all that show is? The Royal Rumble was also in the news quite a bit this week. There were rumors that the Rumble is being expanded once again, only the second time in history, to a 40-man field. That was in some of the reports from people who were allegedly at the SmackDown tapings in Philadelphia. I think Philly has the Rumble in January, so people were saying there was an announcement made that it's going to be a 40-man Rumble. I heard that from a lot of different places. I have yet to hear it confirmed by WWE. So I don't know if this is true or if this is just someone peddling bullshit, but that's the rumor that the Rumble is going back to 40 men. So we'll see. We'll see if that actually happens or not. The last one they did like that was in 2011. Alberto Del Rio won that. I thought the ending of that one was great when Santino popped up out of nowhere. The people were going nuts. They really wanted to see him win, and in the end he fell short. That was also the year, if I remember, that Booker T came back, and I think Kevin Nash as Diesel, which got a huge reaction. So that Rumble had some good moments. I was not a fan of the 40-man format. That's just too many people. They also cut down on the length of time between each entrant. I think it was like 60 seconds between each person. It was just going way too fast for me. And 40 men, way too much filler. You talk about a normal 30-man Royal Rumble being bullshit because we all know who's going to win. A 40-man Rumble is going to be even worse. Because basically, if you look at the Royal Rumble coming up in 2015, if guys are back from injury, you may have Roman Reigns back, Daniel Bryan, plus you'll have some other guys in there as well, some other main event names, maybe Batista. You could have conceivably two or three different people who could win that Royal Rumble match, which would be great, because normally it's only one. So we may have two or three coming up next year. What about the other 37 bodies in there? They're just there for filler. Kofi Kingston will be in there to do his annual spot where, you know, how's he going to get back in the ring? And that's fine, and everyone has their role. But 40 men, when only two or three have a realistic shot of winning, to me, is a waste of time. And I would prefer that they actually give these guys 90 seconds or 2 minutes between entrances the traditional way. Otherwise, it just moves at too fast of a pace. And you know, it just becomes all about the entrances and who can they stick in there. And none of those guys have any chance of even being there at the end. So what's the point? I am not a fan of the 40-man format. I would prefer they keep it at 30. And speaking of the Rumble, Brock Lesnar, I've seen reports that he may not work another match until the Royal Rumble in January. Look, people are taking Brock Lesnar to task. Oh, what a horrible champion he is. Don't blame Brock Lesnar. Blame WWE. They're the ones booking the guy. I'm sure Brock Lesnar would be more than happy to work one or two more pay-per-views, to work Survivor Series, if they wanted him to, provided they pay him. He'll gladly work whatever show they want to work if you pay him what he's asking for. If they don't want to pay him because they're cutting the budget, that's not his fault. That's WWE's fault. They could have him for any show they want. They are making the decision. They are making the choice not to bring him in, if this is true, until January. Don't blame Brock. Blame WWE for that. And people saying, well, he's got to go down as one of the worst champions of all time. Look, I wish we saw Brock more often as well. I wish he was wrestling on this show, killing John Cena inside the cell, so that Dean Ambrose could be left to his own devices to have his match with Seth Rollins and it wasn't in jeopardy because we had to put John Cena in the storyline. Believe me, I wish Brock was around. But I am of the mindset, you stay the course. You keep that belt on him until WrestleMania. Do not panic. Do not change plans. Do not fuck this up. Because when WrestleMania rolls around, he'll have a couple more matches under his belt, whoever he wrestles at the Rumble, which I'm going to get to in a little bit, and whether it's Daniel Bryan, Roman Reigns, Batista, whoever they put in that ring against him, as long as it's not John Cena, God forbid, it's going to be a bigger match. It's going to be a bigger deal when Brock drops that belt. I don't really understand what people are expecting. If Brock was on television every single week, do you think he would be wrestling? Do you actually want to see Brock Lesnar in some random handicap match or six-man tag on Raw every single week to where by week three he won't mean jack shit? Is that what people want? Would it be enough for him to just show up and wave and say hello and wink and then leave? I mean, what do people expect? I assume these are people who just didn't want to put the belt on Brock in the first place. But I don't know what people are expecting. If he's on television every week, what do you expect him to do? He's not going to wrestle. I agree, they should at least tape some vignettes, tape him back home in Minnesota, tape him training. You know what you could do with Brock Lesnar? He's such a good, you know, he comes off as this smug douchebag, this guy that is so hateable, like he's so above the rest of us. Why not tape some vignettes of him with Paul Heyman out in the town? He's out at a steakhouse, like TMZ got them outside of a steakhouse one day. I think it was after Brock won the belt at SummerSlam, might have been that night actually. And they caught them coming out of a steakhouse. That's the kind of place I would expect to see Brock Lesnar. He'd be in there, down in a big T-bone, right? Take a camera crew and just show him, like, living the life. Everywhere he goes, he's got that belt with him. Heyman's holding it, or he's got it on the seat next to him. And he's just being a dick to the waiter. He's being a dick to everybody. He's the conqueror. He's the king. He's living the life of Riley, this guy. You know, you could do stuff like that. I don't know why they haven't. Again, don't blame Brock if they called him and say, hey, listen, we're going to fly a camera crew out to your home in Minnesota. We want to follow you around. We want to tape a few segments with you. We'll send Paul out there. What do you think Brock's going to say? No? He'll be like, all right, do whatever you want. Send him down. So, again, it's WWE's lack of creative when it comes to what to do with this guy that you should be upset about, because there's plenty of stuff they could be doing with Brock Lesnar that doesn't include him being on Raw in the ring every single week. And they don't have any ideas. They don't know what to do. They're too busy booking bullshit celebrity guests and putting midgets in alligator costumes as though people actually want to see that, as though there's a demand for that kind of entertainment. Apparently that's what we want to see. We don't want to see Brock Lesnar. We want to see Mini Gator and El Torito and 60-year-old grandmothers smashing wine bottles over each other's asses. That's what we want to see. That's what Monday Night Raw is all about. So I hold them accountable for this. It's not Brock's fault at all. There's plenty they could be doing, and they're not. So blame WWE. Now, when I look at WrestleMania 31, because there's been a lot of rumors, you know, we talked about Rock Triple H before, what's Brock going to do, who's he going to wrestle, you got Bryan coming back, Roman Reigns is going to come back, it seems like this preordained thing that Roman Reigns is going to wrestle Brock Lesnar in the main event and win the championship, and it's going to be the start of the Roman Reigns era. And if that's their plan, then fine. I hope it works out. I like Roman Reigns. I like Dean Ambrose more, but I still like Roman Reigns. And whether it's WrestleMania 31 or WrestleMania 32, get ready, because the Roman Reigns era is coming, whether you like it or not, so you better learn to embrace it. So there's a lot of questions. What's Sting going to do? So I was thinking about this the other day, and I don't usually do this, but I figured really quickly here before we get to the rest of the show, I tried to kind of fantasy book what a WrestleMania 31 card at this point, and it's still very early, but what that card might look like. And I had a tough time, but this is kind of what I see going on here. I could see a main event at WrestleMania next year, provided he comes back from injury and he's fine, of Daniel Bryan and Brock Lesnar. It's a match that we were supposed to get at SummerSlam that I think had the potential to be really good, and we got cheated out of it. Bryan got cheated out of it. It was a shame. And so they did what they did with Brock and Cena, which was very unique. But I don't think that's the kind of match we would have gotten had Bryan still been the champion. It would have been more competitive. So here we are now. Lesnar is the champion. Bryan's going to be on his way back soon enough. He never lost the championship. There's a story there. Even though the Authority will probably want to throw every roadblock and obstacle in his way, he never did lose the championship. He was never beaten for it. So if he comes back and wins the Royal Rumble and goes on to WrestleMania to fight Brock Lesnar, first of all, I think that'd be a hell of a main event. I think as long as he still has the fan support, he's got the fans behind him, I think it'll make for a great atmosphere. I think there's a story there of the little guy against the big guy, David versus Goliath. Want to see the little guy try to slay the beast. And the way I would see it going down, and the idea I would endorse, is not just the Brock-Bryan match in the main event, but I would endorse Bryan beat him, because I think whoever he wrestles is probably going to beat Brock, whoever it is. And then you can immediately have Seth Rollins cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase, which is something we've never seen at a WrestleMania before. We've never seen a Mania cash-in, not even a Mania cash-in attempt. Rollins finally cashes in, and he wins. And he wins the championship from Bryan at the end of the show. Because as long as Brock Lesnar is the WWE champion, Seth Rollins is not cashing in. Certainly not successfully. So we have to look ahead to whenever Brock finally drops the belt, and then I think we'll see a Money in the Bank cash in. And remember, he doesn't have to cash it in by Mania. He's got a year. So technically, Rollins can cash in at any time between now and I guess next July would be the time. So you have Bryan win the championship. He's got the belt back. Finally, all this time, all the injuries and the rehab and everything. It's a great moment. And here comes Seth Rollins to just fuck it all up. And then you have Bryan chasing Rollins. You could have a whole bunch of people chasing Rollins. You can have Reigns chasing him. You can have, I hate to keep going back to the same guys. I mean, it's impossible to know who the top baby faces will be at that time. Hopefully somebody other than John Cena, maybe Cesaro by that point, who knows. But you can have, there's more money, I think, in Bryan chasing Rollins for the belt than there would be just having Bryan win it and then, you know, hold it for 6 months and waiting for Rollins to cash in. I would prefer that Rollins cash in successfully anyway, and it would be the first time we've ever seen it at a WrestleMania. And you'd have a lot of people very upset, oh, they screwed Daniel Bryan again. It's all part of the story. It's all part of the story. Bryan's been screwed before. It's not the last time I'm sure he'll be screwed. So I could see something like that happening. What do you do with Roman Reigns then, if he's not going to be in the main event against Brock? I think that there is still money on the table in a Roman Reigns-Bray Wyatt feud. We saw a little bit of that when the Wyatt family went up against the Shield, which, I got to tell you, I went back recently and I watched that six-man tag team match from Elimination Chamber and the fans' reactions to those two teams before they even touched. This is awesome chance. I mean, it gave me goosebumps. And to think back, that was in February, and now we're in October. It feels like a lifetime ago. The Wyatt family has been just out, and I don't use this word often, but I'm going to use it now. The Wyatt family has been completely, totally buried. Whether it was done on purpose or by accident because they don't know what the fuck to do with them, they have been buried underneath muck. Every match that the Wyatts had with the Usos, they lost. Every match the Wyatts seemingly had, they lost. And Luke Harper would usually be the one taking the pin, which I can never understand, because I think there's way more upside in Luke Harper than Eric Rowan. Bray Wyatt, what they've done with him is a crime. Now they're breaking them up. Now there is no more Wyatt family. There is no more Shield. And that was just, you know, what was that? 9 months ago? Eight, nine months ago? Maybe not even. And look at how things have changed. Now, the Shield guys seem to be doing okay. You know, they're starting to push them as big single stars. I mean, every week it's the Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose show, and I'm sure it would have been the Roman Reigns show had he not gotten hurt. So, I mean, they broke them up to push them as singles guys, but they still had some mileage left, I think, as a team, had they kept them together a few more months. But that Roman Reigns-Bray Wyatt dynamic, they were kind of the leaders of their own faction. You know, there was a lot of potential there. And we never really got, I mean, maybe there was one singles match that I can't remember, but they never really went in that direction. I think there was a lot of potential there. So even now, I mean, because I see Bray Wyatt and Roman Reigns as being two of the guys that are going to carry this company 5 years from now. I would hope that Bray Wyatt is in a better position in 5 years than he's in right now. But I think you could do a Roman Reigns-Bray Wyatt undercard match at WrestleMania. I think Rock and Triple H, if that really does end up happening, that's great. That's fine. I would have no problem with that. It begs the question, what do you do with Batista? If Batista does come back, and there's been... Yeah, he's actually talked about it. He would love to face Triple H. He wants a match with Triple H at WrestleMania. Maybe that would be it for him. Maybe that would be his swan song. Of those two matches, to be honest with you, I'd prefer Rock and Triple H over Batista Triple H. So I don't know what you do with Batista if you do the Rock Triple H match, but that's the match I would prefer to see. And then the question of Sting. What do you do with the man called Sting? I think it's a foregone conclusion. Sting is wrestling at least one match, probably be at WrestleMania, may even go into the Hall of Fame next year. Probably he'll show up around Royal Rumble time in January and kick off whatever program he's going to be in. And one match I think that they could do at WrestleMania, and it may be the most realistic match at this point, is Randy Orton, the old legend killer. One-on-one with Sting. One of our followers on Twitter, Jay, he even had the perfect setup for the feud when I suggested it to him. With Sting's new DVD out, in case you didn't see the commercials for it, he's got a new DVD out right now. The 2K15 video game being released in a couple of weeks, and he's right there on the on all the advertising for it, and he's the big, you know, pre-order character, and the commercials with him, he's a big part of that video game. It would make sense to have Sting show up on Monday Night Raw this month, sometime in these next couple of weeks. Get the big reaction, talk about how good it feels to finally be inside a WWE ring. I mean, look, would it be cool to have Sting come down from the rafters? Obviously, that's not going to happen. Come out from the back wearing the trench coat with the baseball bat and the black and white face paint like we remember him in 1997? Sure. Sure. That initial appearance, the initial reaction to him would be awesome. It would be great to have that be his first appearance in WWE. And to kick off a feud with somebody like The Undertaker or whoever. But that's not going to happen. He's not coming down from the rafters. The Sting of 1997 is dead. He is dead and buried. This Sting is a lot older. His hair is a lot thinner. He walks around wearing a t-shirt, not a singlet. And frankly, I think The Undertaker, the more I see and I hear about this guy, and I see photos of him, I think he's done. I think there's a very good chance that we have seen The Undertaker wrestle his final match. And so, you know, again, it's not as though your average fan has not seen these Sting mentions on television a million times. They've mentioned his name a lot. They see him in the commercials. It's not like a huge shock. What does this guy look like? I wonder. Like, they know what he looks like. He's been all over the place. It's not a big secret anymore. And I think having him show up for an in-ring promo to promote the video game and to promote all these different things, I'd be okay with that. In a perfect world, it would be all those other things I mentioned. But guess what? The world's not perfect. So you do it that way. Randy Orton comes out towards the end of his promo. Maybe Orton lost at Hell in a Cell. He's just lost his mind. He's gone crazy. He's beside himself. He comes out, ends up punting Sting at the end of the segment, maybe in a fit of rage. And we see some of that Legend Killer come back out. And that way, it gets Sting off television, because I can tell you right now, if you bring Sting back now, and there's a lot of people, as bad as these shows have gotten, begging for Sting to finally show up, you put him on television now, and he doesn't wrestle a match until March, that's going to get real old, real fast. And I would not put my faith in these people that they would know what to do with Sting for the next 6 months to kill time on television before he wrestles that first match. These are the same people, like I said, who don't have enough sense to come up with an idea to send a camera crew to go film Brock Lesnar in his hometown, and you expect that these people have all of these great ideas for Sting, what to do with him over the next 5 or 6 months, just floating around in their brain. Do you really honestly believe that? Because I don't. So you get him off television. You've now planted the seeds for a feud when he comes back, and you bring him back around January or so. Maybe he screws Orton over in the Royal Rumble, and you build to a match between the two of them at WrestleMania. If Undertaker can't go, and John Cena and Triple H, who were two other opponents I know that Sting has floated the idea of wrestling, if they're occupied in other matches, Orton makes sense to me as an opponent. I mean, Bray Wyatt could work too. You know, the mind games between them could be cool to watch, but I like the idea of picking up with Reigns and Wyatt. Like I said, that would be the match I would want to go towards if Reigns is not challenging for the championship. So that's one idea for Sting. Sting and Orton at WrestleMania. And then, of course, you could do Cena and Rusev. It just seems to me like that's the end game with Rusev. They're building him up for John Cena. I was shocked that they did John Cena versus Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania this year. So nothing would surprise me anymore. If they wanted to do Cena-Rusev, I could see them doing that. Wouldn't surprise me at all. With Rusev finally losing a match. I know there's rumors of Cena and Hulk Hogan, but that ain't happening. Trust me, that ain't happening. So, you know, the only other question is now, what do you do with Rollins? I mean, Rollins may cash in at the end, but he's got to have another match on the show. So what do you do with guys like Seth Rollins? What do you do with Dean Ambrose? What do you do with, you know, let alone the Sorrows and Zigglers of the world? There's a lot of unanswered questions. Again, I just kind of sketched this out in my brain as I sit here now today in October 2014, what this WrestleMania card might look like. So that's just one, you know, variation of it. I'm sure a lot of you guys have different cards in your mind and different ideas for what they could do. But as the lay of the land is right now, that's kind of how I see things. So let's move on here. I think we've yakked enough about that. Time to get to Monday Night Raw, which aired from Brooklyn, New York, this past week at the Barclays Center. WWE delivered a nice birthday surprise to me last Monday with the return of The Rock. He had tweeted out a photo of himself in New York City earlier in the day, so I thought there might be a chance of him being there. I really didn't expect it, but I thought there was at least a chance. I was not, however, expecting him to show up in a segment with Rusev. That was a huge shock to all of us. So when he came out, I mean, what I would compare it to, being there live in the building, I was in Miami the night after WrestleMania 28, and the reaction that Rock got here rivaled the reaction that Brock Lesnar got that night when he first came out, which was huge. People went nuts for this guy when he came out. So that was a nice little birthday surprise. I wish I could say the same for the rest of the show, but I can't. It was another boring show. And if you take away The Rock, you've got yourself a dud. To say The Rock saved this show, I can't even say that, you know, he saved the show. I can't even say it would be an understatement, because I'm not sure he did save the entire show. You know, one segment cannot make up for the other 2 hours and 45 minutes. But being there live, it overshadowed everything else on the show. And think about how sad that is. You watch this guy out there and you realize he's just leagues ahead of everybody else right now. As far as star power, and I know he made $50 million so far this year for his movies alone. Put that aside. Take the movie stuff away. His star power still far surpasses anyone else that they've got. And that's on them. That's on WWE for doing a poor job of creating new stars and handicapping the ones that they have created. Dean Ambrose is fantastic, but there's still only so much he can do with, you know, the PG handcuffs and just the general way that they book these guys. You could say they've done a good job with the Shield guys, but who else? You know, therein lies the problem. When Rock left and the segment ended, I thought about leaving. Not going to lie, I'm not the only one either. I'm sure plenty of people in the building were like, well, that's it. Let's pack up and head out. You know, I mean, there was no topping what we had just seen. From the surprise element to, you know, it was an entertaining segment. Everything about it went on for like 15 minutes. I mean, there was nothing else on the entire show that could possibly top what we had just witnessed. I said to my friend kind of jokingly, and he agreed. He was like, yeah, we should get the hell out of here. You know, there's still 45 minutes left in the show, and there's nowhere else to go but down. So that was one of the negatives, I guess, of doing it when they did. I know why they did. I guess the football game went to halftime. That's their new gimmick now. Whenever football goes to halftime, we got to do something to get people to watch our show. So that's why they did it at the 10 o'clock, I guess the top of the 10 o'clock hour. Part of it, you know, part of the problem here with that mentality of it's all downhill from here, you know, part of it is the length of the show. And I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but fuck it. It's already dead. I don't think it would mind. The show is too fucking long. As bad as it is on television, it's just as bad in the building with all the dead space between segments. You know, there will never again truly be what I call a great episode of Raw as long as they maintain the three-hour format. It's impossible. A good show? Yeah. A really good show? Maybe. Not with these writers. Not with these guys writing the show, but a great show? It's not possible. You can have great moments like The Rock's return, but having all that time to fill, they're always going to have throwaway comedy segments and celebrity bullshit that just makes you cringe. Case in point, there were two segments on this show, not one, but two, that were an absolute embarrassment. And shockingly, neither one involved Rosa Mendez or the Bella Twins, which was a big surprise. And to their credit, there was one really classy segment towards the end of the show. So why don't we break it down here? First, the building was packed. I don't know how it came across on television. I think from what little I saw, from what I watched on YouTube, it did look pretty packed. You know, people wonder why they don't go to Madison Square Garden as much anymore. I guess the expenses are such that it's a lot cheaper to run Brooklyn. But MSG better be careful, because you've got this brand new building that's literally right next to the train. And I know the Garden is too, you know, but Penn Station's a dump. They're going to be running Brooklyn a lot more than they are Madison Square Garden, and I'm okay with that. So the building was packed, sold out, over 15,000 people. Keep in mind, the only thing I've gone back and watched on TV is the Rock and Rusev segment. I wasn't sitting through this show a second time with commentary. That's the advantage of being there live. I didn't have to suffer through the announcers. In fact, my friend's wife, who was she's a casual fan, and she had never been to a live WWE show before. She had only been to the TNA baseball park shows that we dragged her to, the poor girl. She was with us, and even she was, she said to me at one point she was happy that she didn't have to listen to the announcers. It was so much better. So when your casual fans are put off by the announcing, you know it's bad. Zack Ryder beat Heath Slater in the dark match. I was in line grabbing a pretzel, so I missed the whole thing. Sorry, Zack. Naomi pinned Cameron with the rear view in the Superstars match, and so then we were off to the races. Now, apparently Big Show was being sent to sensitivity training. I think they had a graphic up at one point that said that that's the only way we in the arena knew what was going on, because, you know, in the building it was tough to figure out. They had announced a match the week before. It was supposed to be Big Show against Rusev on this show. And I actually liked the fact that they promoted a match in advance for a change. That's something I think they should do more of. So, how silly of me to think they would actually remember that. Sure enough, we come to Raw Monday night. No match. They change their minds, which they do all the fucking time. Dean Ambrose, super over in the building all night long. Second best reaction from the crowd behind The Rock. I mean, everybody was behind The Rock. I'd put Ambrose in number two, followed by Damian Mizdow, of all people. People love Mizdow. Dolph Ziggler put him in fourth, bringing up the rear. Lots of love for the Intercontinental Champion in Brooklyn, you know, the guy who got jobbed out to Rusev on SmackDown. So now my question about that, will Rusev now get an Intercontinental title match? I mean, he beat the champ. He made the champ tap out. Doesn't that earn him a title shot? Of course not. Of course not, because the titles mean shit. Ziggler and the Usos beat Cesaro and the Dust Brothers opening match, best match on the entire show, which should tell you everything you need to know since we still had about 2.5 hours left in the show by this point. Triple super kick spot by the baby faces to Stardust, followed by a long-distance Uso splash to get the 1-2-3. This was real good. Adam Rose and the Exotic Express then came out with Kathy Lee Gifford and Hoda Kotb from the Today Show. This may have been the single most pointless segment in the history of Monday Night Raw. They sat in chairs in the middle of the ring. They got booed out of the building. Hoda danced. And for those of you asking me what the fuck is a Hoda, I still have no idea. They drank some wine, smashed some wine bottles, and fell backwards into all the rosebuds. That's it. That's literally all that they did. And it was pointed out to me this week. I saw an item online that somebody linked me to. Kathy Lee, in her autobiography 20 years ago, so we're going back a ways here, but 20 years ago in her autobiography, once referred to Ravishing Rick Rude and the Bushwhackers, both of whom had been on their show. Again, it used to be the Regis and Kathy Lee show for God knows how many years. Poor Regis. They were on the air together. And Regis was a huge wrestling fan. Huge wrestling fan. So he would have them on all the time. I mean, you could find videos on YouTube. He had The Undertaker and Paul Bearer in character were on the show once. Yokozuna was on there either with Fuji or Jim Cornette. I can't remember. Just a ton of wrestlers he would have on the show. And so in the book, she referred to them as smelly and disgusting, and went as far as to say that Rick Rude's appearance on their show marked a low point in class for the show. And the whole thing about low class, it's so hilarious to me, given that she may well have set a new low mark for class on Monday Night Raw with this segment that she appeared in. And that's a hard thing to do, believe me. To set the bar that low on Raw, that's pretty low. I had to sit in the stands during this show and watch Granny break a wine bottle over another woman's ass. What a classy lady. The picture of class, Kathy Lee Gifford. And I loved how she went for the cheap pop by pleading with everybody, "My mother was born in Brooklyn," as if that's supposed to impress all of us. Guess what? It didn't. They got exactly the reaction you would have expected. They got exactly the reaction they deserved. And the next morning on the Today Show, they talked about their experience. Hoda called it exhilarating, so she seemed to take it as a good sport. Kathy Lee, on the other hand, claimed that she was against appearing on the show in the first place. She had to be convinced to do it. You know, like somebody put a gun to her head. This is all coming from a woman who once made an autistic kid cry on national television. Who wrote a song about being alone because the kid was sitting all alone in the cafeteria at school one day and some kid befriended him, and somehow this became a national news story. And then she brings her Broadway singer friend on the Today Show to sing the song that she has written for this kid in front of the kid who, if you watch the video, and it pisses me off now just thinking about it, let alone the first time I saw this a couple of years ago, this poor kid is so embarrassed and so shy. He's sitting on the couch with all these other people, wants to be anywhere but there. And this woman, she brings out this Broadway singer to sing the song that Kathy Lee has written about this kid, to sing it in front of him. And this kid is crying through the entire thing. And then when it's over, Kathy Lee, she's sitting there, and she goes, "Oh, hey, buddy, I saw that you had tears in your eyes. Did you like your song?" And the poor kid goes, "Yeah, that was a little too sad." But he doesn't say it jokingly like he meant it. He said it very sheepishly, and everybody on the set starts laughing, like it's a big fucking joke. One of the saddest things I've ever seen. The look of just pain and embarrassment on this poor kid's face when that song was over. A song that was titled All Alone. Now, it's bad enough the song sucked. I mean, seriously, one of the worst things you could do to a child like that, that was more, she was more concerned about what people thought of her fucking song than what she was doing to the kid. There's a lot of dumb shit this woman has said over the years that should have earned her a lifetime ban from television. She interviewed Martin Short once on TV and asked him how things are going with his wife, not realizing that his wife had died years earlier from ovarian cancer. How does something like that even happen? How did Regis tolerate sitting next to her for all those years? He has to be a wrestling fan to put up with that much shit for so many years. She's a miserable pig of a person, and WWE ought to do a better job of screening these people before they put them on their show. Because just based on the comments she made about their own performers, Rick Rude, you know, God rest his soul, he's been gone now for a number of years, And clearly he was in character with Bobby Heenan on the show. They're all in character. Go back and watch any of those videos. They're in fucking character. And this woman writes a book and just completely trashes them like they're subhuman, just the lowest form of the low. So all these years later, they invite her on the show. They give her publicity. They enable her. She's got no business being on TV. Why is she employed? Why does she have a job? That's what I want to know. She never should have been on the show in the first place. The show, this segment was an abomination. Largely because of her. And whatever that dance was that Hoda did. I have no fucking clue what that was all about. This was a fail on every conceivable level. We have Bo Dallas beating Mark Henry by countout in 2 minutes. And from where I was sitting, it looked bad because it looked like Mark Henry had a stall just not to get back in the ring in time. Plus, the match sucked, so everything about this was pretty much awful. We had a segment with John Cena and Dean Ambrose in the ring, butting heads. They're not exactly bosom buddies. It ended with Ambrose basically telling John Cena, hey, good luck later. They were supposed to be John Cena and Dean Ambrose against Seth Rollins, Kane, and Randy Orton. And Ambrose said, good luck with that. I'm out of here. I'm going to Coney Island. I'm going to ride the Wonder Wheel, maybe grab a hot dog. And sure enough, he left, and we saw footage later on of him going down into the subway, hopping on the Q train, which is the train that I take every single week, so that was kind of funny. One little faux pas here, and if you're not from New York, you have no idea, but if you are from New York and you do take the Q train, then you know how funny it was. The train station right outside the Barclays Center, it's the Atlantic Avenue station. The next station as you go towards Coney Island is called 7th Avenue. If you'll notice, when Ambrose came down the steps into the train station, it was the 7th Avenue train station. So perhaps Dean Ambrose wanted to take a nice jog, and he walked all the way to the next subway stop before going underground. That would make no sense, of course. So that was a little fuck-up on their part. But off he went. He boarded the train, and off to Coney Island he went. I think they missed a real opportunity here. You know, for a company that loves doing comedy, they missed a real chance to do some real comedy for a change by sending a camera crew with Ambrose to Coney Island to kind of track him as he went around. I guess you couldn't do it earlier in the day because it would have been daylight outside. It would have been a giveaway. And to send him there live, you run the risk of him not making it back to the arena in time. They should have just taped it the night before, if that was the case. That would have been gold. I'm not even sure if the amusements over there at Luna Park are still open right now. They may already be closed. Send them anyway. Just the idea of Dean Ambrose roaming around Coney Island at night is gold. We had Brie Bella beating Summer Rae in 1 minute 55 seconds with one arm tied behind her back. Nikki had come out. I don't think this is something you guys saw. Nikki Bella came out. She cut a promo dark in the arena. She said, you know, you people probably think I'm just some Brooklyn bimbo, and she went on and on. I'm pretty sure when they came on the air, what you guys saw, she was probably already just standing on the stage with a microphone in her hand. Brie, you know, poor Brie had to stand in the ring for a good 5 minutes straight with her arm tied behind her back through a commercial break. There was, I think, a backstage segment until they finally came back live to the ring. So if you ever wondered, do the Divas just stand there waiting through all of these segments? The answer is yes. Jack Swagger beat Tyson Kidd with the ankle lock. Good to see Tyson getting some ring time on Raw. They furthered the tension between Natty and himself. Lots of Natty's husband chants, so we had plenty of NXT fans in the crowd. Then we had the exclusive Roman Reigns interview. You heard a snippet of the interview at the beginning of the podcast, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that was about 30% of the interview right there, what you heard. This was the most useless interview, just a complete waste of a segment. I think Roman was there, as far as I know. I know he was in New York City the day before because he did an autograph signing at the Ringside Fest event. So he was definitely in town. He was probably in the back. Why they didn't have him come out on stage, why they didn't have him come out to the ring, I have no idea. It just, you know, it's just so stupid. He literally, Michael Cole asks him, how are you doing? What's the update? And so Roman Reigns gives us a very quick update. Things are going well, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it was so obviously taped earlier in the day. It was so obviously pre-recorded because he left these little pauses in there for the crowd to react. So at one point he said, you know, I'll be back soon, you know, putting on the vest and kicking ass. And that was clearly one of those moments. Like, if you ever looked at a leaked copy of the Raw script, you'll see these parts where it has like three stars, three asterisks. That's usually a symbol of, okay, pause for crowd reaction. I bet in the script for Raw, when Reigns said that line, they had those three little fucking stars and nobody reacted. And so I'm sitting in the crowd and I'm watching this on screen and I can't tell if maybe Michael Cole is asking him a question and that's why he kind of paused, and then when he started answering the next question, it looked like he was responding to another question from Michael Cole. I went back and watched it. Nope. That was just a long pause for people to react, and they didn't. And it was so sad, and it made him look so bad. It just came off so bad in the building. And I imagine, just watching it back, it came back bad on television. This segment was a failure in every conceivable way. This did not make Roman Reigns look good at all. I don't know why they didn't just send him out there. And if he couldn't go out there, maybe he hasn't been able to work out, so they're worried about his physique. Although I don't think, look, he can't be that much smaller. It's only been a few weeks. You put fucking long sleeve shirt on, it's not a problem. I just don't understand why they would allow something like this to make the air. It came off horribly, didn't make him look good at all. Speaking of segments that were no good at all, that should not have made the airwaves, we had El Torito one-on-one with Mini Gator, one of the most embarrassing segments in the history of Monday Night Raw. The crowd chanted, "This is stupid," which I hope the announcers acknowledged. Knowing Jerry Lawler, he probably, you know, claimed they were chanting, "This is awesome! Hey, 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 this is awesome!" That's all I hear when I hear Jerry Lawler. I hear, "Oh my God, hey, hey." He sounds like the Pillsbury Doughboy. That's all I hear. This was not awesome, in fact. This sucked. How out of touch these people must be with what the fans want to see, that they would put this out there on national television, in Brooklyn, of all places, that they would think people would actually be entertained by this. It's amazing. You know, I know they gave us The Rock in the very next segment, but we get one-offs like that every now and then. That's cool. We get stupid comedy bullshit like this every single week. Week after week after week. Do they honestly think this is what people want to see? There were kids in the crowd, in my section, watching this, who looked like they were thinking the same thing. Like, what the hell is this? What audience are they going for? That's what I want to know. Because it ain't working with the kids. I was proud of Brooklyn during this segment. This segment was stupid. And I'm glad they let them know that. And then came the best thing. We went from the worst thing, maybe the second worst thing on the entire show. It's in competition with the Kathy Lee segment. But we went from the worst to the best. By a country mile. Out comes Rusev and Lana. Rusev Putria, Rusev Machka. I happen to like Rusev's theme song, Sue Me. I think it's one of the more underrated themes in WWE. I went to look up what that means, by the way, the stuff he says at the beginning of the song. The consensus seems to be that he's saying Rusev hits, Rusev squish, or Rusev crush. I guess squish and crush are interchangeable. Although one person who is from Serbia says the word Machka actually means cat in Serbian. So it annoys him because every time Rusev comes out, all he hears is Rusev cat. I think is pretty funny. So they come out, they're cutting a promo on the Big Show. We're supposed to be getting some Big Show insensitivity training segment. He's not allowed to come out or something. And out comes The Rock. His music hits, people lose their shit, they're jumping up and down, they can't believe it. It's one of the few times that we got a genuine surprise on Monday Night Raw. It's very hard to keep things secret these days. Although apparently Rock went on Twitter like 30 seconds before he came out and spoiled it anyway. But he came out, people were going nuts. I went back again, I watched the segment when I got home. Michael Cole was just going out of his mind, you know, oh my! And I thought he did a fine job. Of course, Lawler, you know, Lawler was Lawler. You get what you're going to get with Jerry Lawler in the year 2014. The Rock comes out, it's like he's parroting whatever Michael Cole said. So Michael Cole is like, oh my! And of course, Jerry Lawler's like, what? What? Oh my God, it's The Rock! Oh my God! That's all I hear when I hear Jerry Lawler. I hear the fucking Pillsbury Doughboy. That's exactly what he sounds like. Whenever he reacts in that high-pitched voice, he has nothing to say. I want to do a segment one day on the show. I so badly wanted to do this for an intro, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. I wanted to take that segment when The Rock came out, and I wanted to get rid of the crowd noise, I wanted to get rid of all the noise, and just isolate Jerry Lawler's commentary. It's incredible, because if you just isolate Jerry Lawler's commentary, all you get, you would have no idea what's going on. All you would get is, oh, oh my God, oh, The Rock! Oh my God! That's all you're going to get. Great commentary. Fantastic. Oh my God. I do have to say, nobody commands a crowd like The Rock. Everybody in the building was on their feet. Everybody was hanging on to every word that this man said. I mean, it's been a long time since he's been on Raw. I don't think he's been on Raw since probably the lead up to WrestleMania last year for that match with John Cena. He was at WrestleMania this year. Maybe he was on a Raw episode between then and now that I'm not remembering. So it was a genuine, you know, big moment that he would show up unannounced the way that he did. It was also his Brooklyn debut. That was the first time The Rock has made an appearance at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. That building's only been open since 2012. So it was a big moment. People were really into it. They were on their feet. It was the best thing on the entire show. I mean, I don't need to rehash what was said. He went back and forth with Rusev. He praised Lana as being hot. I think he called her smoking, which she is. And I still say Lana's going to be one of the biggest things in that company when she eventually ditches the Russian accent and lets her hair down and lays off the lipstick a little bit. But, you know, Rock and Rusev ended up, actually it was more Rock kicking his ass. He gave him some punches, knocked him out of the ring. And now a lot of people wondering, ooh, does this mean Rock and Rusev at WrestleMania? No. No. At no point did I think, well, that's probably going to be a WrestleMania match. No. There's no way that's going to be a WrestleMania match. It was just something for The Rock to do. He was in town, I think, for meetings, probably movie meetings. And they probably went, listen, our show sucks lately. We would really love it if you kind of breathe some life into it for us. And that's what he did. He showed up and, you know, it was like we were transported to a different era where Raw actually wasn't as shitty as it is these days. Paige and Alicia Fox beat AJ Lee and Emma. Very happy to see Emma on Raw. Paige pinned Emma with the Rampage after AJ walked out on her partner. I guess AJ couldn't take the stupid dancing stuff that Emma was doing and she wouldn't tag in, so AJ jumped off the apron. She deserted her partner and she walked up the entranceway. Hell of a babyface. She walked out. So that at least makes one thing she has in common with her husband. The Miz beat Sheamus, but enough about those two. The star of this match here was Damian Mizdow. You know you suck when your stunt double is more over than you are. People loved Mizdow, and if you watch him, this is the new thing now. Whenever Miz wrestles, and I think Miz, look, the character that Miz plays is fine. It's a perfectly fine, douchey, heel, mid-card character. It's not a main event character at all. But I find myself, instead of watching The Miz, who I find boring, I watch Mizdow. And I think I'm looking around, everybody is reacting. You know, Mizdow is basically mimicking whatever movements The Miz is doing inside the ring. When Miz is hurt, Sandow is hurt. It's just, he's so incredible. He has owned this role. He has owned it. He has made it his own, and he has now gotten himself more over than the guy that he's been partnered with, which was probably, I'm guessing, not the intent. Knowing WWE, they'll probably punish him for it and break up the act. Don't be shocked in the next few weeks if The Miz turns on Sandow. Can't let him get too over. Can't let that happen. He's so great, though. Then came the segment with Joan London, who is battling breast cancer herself right now. Joan London has been a news personality for a long, long time. Going back a couple of decades, she used to be one of the co-anchors on Good Morning America. I don't really know what she's been up to these days. She's been off television for a long time. But she showed up and talked about breast cancer, talked about her battle. She named each of the women they had in the front row who have battled breast cancer. I thought that this segment didn't fit on the show, not because they shouldn't have done it. I thought this segment was great. It was really one of the classiest things they've ever done. But in the context of such an awful show, with so much bad comedy and bad celebrity bullshit, it just felt out of place. It was almost like, I'm glad they did it, but of all the nights for this segment to be part of Monday Night Raw, it didn't really fit in on this show. I wish this segment could have been part of a better show. But it was one of the highlights of the night, and people in the building largely reacted to it well. They didn't boo it like they did, you know, Kathy Lee earlier in the night. They were very respectful. There were some people behind us that kept shouting as she was trying to talk. And at first, it almost sounded like they were saying, like, we have cancer. And it was like, shut the hell up. And you turn around, I think they were saying, we hate cancer. But it was hard for people to understand, so they were getting the evil eye look from a lot of the fans down below. When somebody is in the crowd talking like that, even if you mean well, just shut up. There's no need to chant anything. Just let them speak. So I thought this was quite good. And that brought us to the main event, which was a 3-on-1 handicap match. The Authority, Seth Rollins, Kane, and Randy Orton against John Cena, 3-on-1 handicap match. This was amazing for the finish. Now, we've seen a lot of DQ finishes on WWE television over the last several weeks. It is the new distraction roll-up. I guess they're too cheap to pay money to charity like I challenge them to every single time they do that finish. So instead, they've pivoted a little bit. Now they're doing DQs instead. Cheap bastards. So, but this was the most amazing DQ I've seen yet. We've seen Seth Rollins run in. We've seen Kane run in. I've seen the memes online of Kane, which I find kind of funny. It's these close-up shots of Kane saying, "That's a mighty fine match you're having there. Would be a shame if somebody interfered." And everyone kind of makes a joke about it. But here, the Authority was disqualified because Kane came into the ring. Kane was the illegal man. He came into the ring. He delivered a boot, a big boot, to John Cena, and the referee called for the DQ. Now, you can imagine being in the building and not having the benefit of commentary and understanding what was going on. We had no fucking idea what just happened. Surely they did not disqualify this man because he delivered a big boot. But oh yes, that is exactly what happened. One of the shittiest finishes I have ever seen. Somehow they managed to top themselves with these DQs every single week. I can only imagine what somebody will be DQ'd for next week. Perhaps trash-talking the opponent. So Ambrose came back from Coney Island. He came back with a hot dog cart. He had ketchup and mustard that he sprayed all over Kane and Randy Orton, and then he attacked them in the ring, and there was a big brawl to end the show. That's when Triple H came out and announced that at Hell in a Cell, they are in fact going with the idea that was floated on the dirt sheets that are never right. So they are doing John Cena versus Dean Ambrose to open the pay-per-view, and the winner of that match will get Seth Rollins later in the night inside Hell in a Cell. And we have since learned on SmackDown, the John Cena versus Dean Ambrose match at Hell in a Cell will be a contract on a pole match. Somewhere at his home in Colorado, wherever the hell he lives now, Vince Russo is no doubt whacking off into a tube sock at the idea that not only are they going to have a pole match at this next pay-per-view, they're going to open the show with it. John Cena and Dean Ambrose in a pole match. First person to bring down the contract will get to wrestle Seth Rollins later in the show. It's obvious why they're doing this. I believe that Dean Ambrose is wrestling Seth Rollins in the main event of that pay-per-view. Now, unfortunately, what that means is, if John Cena loses, that almost guarantees us a match between John Cena and Randy Orton. I understand that. I am not happy about that. But Dean Ambrose has to wrestle Seth Rollins on this show. I don't want to see a three-way. I don't want to see a four-way. It's got to be one-on-one inside Hell in a Cell. This is what they've been building towards ever since the Shield broke up. You put these two guys in a cage, and you let them beat the hell out of each other. You let Ambrose get a hold of Seth Rollins, free of interference from the Authority, even though you know damn well they're going to find a way inside that cell one way or the other. But that's what the main event of that pay-per-view needs to be. I believe that's what that main event will be. But it protects John Cena. So John Cena does not have to lose by pinfall. He can just say, well, you beat me, you raced up the pole in time, and you grabbed the contract before I could. Good job, kid. You know, I mean, that's why they're doing this. I mean, look, maybe there's the off chance that John Cena will win, and it protects Dean Ambrose. They're so hung up on protecting people that don't have to be protected. Like, I get it. If there's a younger guy or a newer star and you want to protect them, that's fine. But does John Cena really need to be protected? Wouldn't it mean more to Dean Ambrose if he got a big pinfall win out of nowhere or with his move in the middle of the ring over John Cena? Wouldn't that be a bigger deal? Wouldn't that give him more momentum heading into that match with Seth Rollins? Do we really need the fucking pole stipulation? I mean, I'm a fan of stipulation matches depending on what they are. A pole match, that's the best you could come up with, a pole match. Next week, they're going to have NeNe Leakes. Am I saying that right? Because if I'm not, I don't care. She's on that Real Housewives of Atlanta show. She's the guest celebrity on Raw Monday night. Don't fucking ask me why. I have no clue. I have no idea why this woman is going to be on the show Monday night. Other than the fact that they're in Atlanta. That's it. That's literally the only reason I think they're bringing her to this show. And if that isn't bad enough, they announced on WWE.com this week that Todd Chrisley of Chrisley Knows Best will also be on Monday Night Raw. And to that, I say this. I make this plea to WWE. Please, for the love of God, pay whatever the man wants to fly Brock Lesnar to Raw this Monday night in Atlanta and put him in the ring at the same time with Nana Leakes or Nene Leakes or Nena Leakes or whatever the fuck her name is and Todd Chrisley at the same time. Just put Brock Lesnar in the ring with them. That's all I ask. Put him in the ring with both of them and let nature take its course. NXT this past Thursday was not the strongest show that they've had. In fact, it was one of the weaker ones, I thought. So let's just get right into it here. Open with Tyler Breeze and Mojo Rawley. If you remember, week before, Tyler had come out for a match and kind of brushed Mojo, or Mojo brushed him as Mojo was leaving after his latest defeat, and that irked Tyler, who then attacked him. So here we are now, one-on-one. They have a match. And in just a few short minutes, Tyler Breeze beats Mojo Rawley with an armbar, working over Mojo's previously injured shoulder. Again, when he beat up Mojo the week before, he had thrown him into the ring post. And it wasn't that Mojo tapped out. The referee actually used his discretion and stopped the match because Tyler would not release the hold. It was a pretty strong Fujiwara armbar. He was cranking back on the arm and the shoulder, and the ref just stopped it. So another loss for Mojo Rawley. And somebody pointed out they took Mojo out of the opening of the show. I didn't notice that, so, I mean, is that true? Because if it is, I'm thinking the dude may be on the endangered species list with what's been going on with him lately. Not a good time to be Mojo Rawley. We had another great vignette with Big Kaz and Enzo Amore recorded earlier in the day. Enzo grabbed the general manager, William Regal, and had him watch a few seconds of Carmella practicing in the ring. He begged him, he said, look, just take a look at her. I think you may like what you see. It's hard not to with Carmella. I think anybody who looks at her is probably going to like what they see. So he watched very intently for a few seconds and then liked what he saw, and he told Enzo, bring her back next week for a tryout. So afterwards, she pretended to not even know who William Regal was. She completely no-sold it when he mentioned when Enzo mentioned Regal's name. But he said that she earned the tryout, and she was very happy. She hugged Big Kaz and left Enzo hanging. He then told Kaz, I know you're going to post this segment anyway like you do all the other ones, and so he just walked away. These guys are so great together, all three of them. You know, I was a little worried about adding another element here to the relationship. I thought Kaz and Enzo on their own were great. Carmella so far, she just fits in. She's like a glove. She fits in perfectly with the two of them. I hope they never break up and they retire together. Just keep these guys together for the rest of their career and I'll be happy. Unfortunately, they did lose to the Vaudevillains later in the show. Aiden English pinned Enzo with their That's a Wrap finish. So, you know, those guys are over enough where losing is not that big of a deal. But I almost feel like they're losing too often. You know, even when Enzo was out with the broken leg and Kaz was doing his own thing, you know, he's a big dude, 7 feet tall. And he was losing to guys on the show that he had no business losing to, including Aiden English. Aiden English would beat him clean with his finish in the middle of the ring, and I can never understand why they were jobbing him out so much. And I still feel the same way about the two of them, but they're over. And when they make the main roster, I don't know how far they're going to go with that gimmick. I don't see them being main event level or anything like that. But you know, you put them together as a tag team on Raw and SmackDown, wrestling for the belt and coming out and doing some comedy. I think Enzo is so charismatic, you know, on promos, that will carry him a long way. But kind of like the Wyatt family, I think splitting the two of them up would probably be bad news for Colin Cassidy. He's not strong enough on his own as a wrestler to go, I think, far enough unless he makes some strides on his own promos, which he has. He's gotten better. But, you know, when he's in there with Enzo, I mean, boy, you realize how far behind everybody else is. Then we had Hideo Itami and Victor of the Ascension in a one-on-one match. This was not good. This was not a good showing for Itami, and this was not a good match. This was the worst of his appearances so far. First of all, the crowd was, it was funny because I even made a remark to somebody. It was like a Japanese crowd, only the Japanese crowd will actually react to the big spots and they're quiet out of respect. These people were not quiet out of respect. They were quiet because they were bored, I guess. I don't know. I think this was only the second taping. I mean, maybe it was the third, but I want to say it was the second taping of a four-taping night. So it's not like it was the end of a long night and they were tired. I really don't know what to make of this. I hope it's just a one-week aberration, and maybe next week the crowd will be more lively and upbeat, but that did worry me. When I say it was silent for this match, there was more noise on Impact in that building in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, from the air conditioning. At least there was some noise. Here, you could hear a pin drop. I mean, that's how quiet it was at Full Sail for this match. And actually, for most of the show, it wasn't just this match, but this match is where I really noticed it. And as far as the match itself, Itami looked a little rough. I mean, there were some moves that he did, and there was one move where he got Victor down in the corner, and Itami is supposed to kind of run in and then leap up into the air with like a diving drop kick down into Victor, who's crouched down in the corner. Even that, I mean, it looked very weak. He just looked off, and I'm not quite sure why. He looked just very much off. We had Connor come out with Sho Funaki, who was on the show the week before. Remember, Funaki showed up backstage. He told Itami, hey, I'm going to watch your back. I got your back. Don't worry about it. So out comes Connor onto the stage, and he's dragging Funaki's lifeless body. He's obviously beaten him to a pulp. And at that point, I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. We're going to get a distraction finish, a distraction roll-up finish in this match. And they teased it, but Itami got out of it, and he ended up winning with like a one-legged drop kick to the face. So I know, Daniel Bryan took his running knee, so I guess he can't use that anymore. But he's got to come up with something better than that. It was basically a very weak-looking one-legged drop kick to the face, and that was it. He pinned him 1-2-3. Eventually, Connor came down to the ring. They double-teamed Itami. Funaki came down, tried to make the save. They tied Itami up in the ropes. His mouth looked like it was busted open a little bit. So now he's tied up. He's helpless. They use the Fall of Man finish on Funaki. Just wipe him out completely. The dude is dead. Itami's tied up in the ropes. There's nothing he can do. And so we go to a little commercial. We come back and we see footage of Itami and the doctors and the officials tending to Funaki. It was a very sad, somber moment. They had to stretcher him out. So that was the whole segment. Like I said, I was not left with a good impression about Itami. But it's one segment. It's 1 week. It's not going to kill the dude. I think everybody's tune will be different 5 or 6 weeks from now when you-know-who makes his debut. And it's just one of those things where they've got a lot of time they've got to kill now between now and then. And I think it's probably not the last beatdown of Itami by the Ascension that we're going to see. But I think to where we're going with this, it's worth the wait. So for this week, not a good week. Hopefully they'll have a rebound next week. Sasha Banks beat Becky Lynch. Looks like Lita when she comes out. Beat her with the backstabber, roll over into a crossface submission that she's now calling the bank statement. I love it. I think that's really cool. I used my stopwatch on the match. They went about 7 minutes. And that's one Divas match on a one-hour show. They have three Divas matches on a three-hour show a couple weeks ago, and they combine for that length of time. So, generally speaking, if you're a woman, if you're a man, you're going to get more time to do your thing on NXT. That's one of the things I like about the show. Main event was Titus O'Neil beating Sami Zayn with his sit-out spine buster, Clash of the Titus. Now, on the one hand, they're probably building Titus for a title shot against Adrian Neville, so it makes sense that he wins here. But on the other hand, Titus is a joke on television. He is booked as a complete and total joke. He gets beaten up by a fucking bunny. And here he is getting a clean win over one of their biggest prospects. It's tough to reconcile that. Because Titus is not bad. And I feel like, he might even flourish if he were to be down at NXT for a while. Although I don't expect him to be down there for very long. But the way he's booked on television, it doesn't help Sami Zayn to lose to a guy who's getting punked out by a bunny rabbit on television every single week. So that's the one thing about it I didn't like. If you look at it on its own as a completely independent show, then it wasn't bad. I think I made that comment last week. You know, when they send guys like Titus down there, it's kind of similar to the old territory system. When a guy was either not being used well or he had outlived his usefulness in one territory, to keep him fresh, he would leave for several months and go somewhere else. And it's, you know, on a much different scale. I'm not saying it's the exact same thing, but I almost feel like that's kind of what they do with some of these main roster guys when they send them down there. It did wonders for Tyson Kidd. I mean, Tyson Kidd now is a completely different performer, both as mainly as a character. I mean, he was always a great wrestler. But I look at Tyson Kidd now, and it's like night and day. I mean, they were doing nothing with him before. And then he went to NXT, and he turned this character into something that was genuinely entertaining and genuinely interesting. And it just so happens that now people are recognizing him for his skills. He always had the in-ring skills. He just, they never paid attention to his character development. Now they did, and he's great. Now on Raw, he's still a small fish in a big pond. You know, there he is on television losing to Jack Swagger. But at least they're doing something with him now. It's had a positive impact on his career, at least in that way. Maybe we'll be able to say the same in a few months for Titus O'Neil. I'm guessing not, but in any event, match itself was okay. I was not a big fan of it. If you love bear hugs, then you probably love this match. After the match, Titus threatened to kill Sammy with a dive off the top rope. Adrian Neville ran down to make the save. He pulled Sammy out of harm's way. And we faded out with Neville looking up at Titus. So, the moral of the story here is they can't all be winners. They did advance the key storylines, and some of the action was good. But I was kind of bored by this episode, to be honest. It's obvious the Titus stuff with Neville is just the kill time until they get to Sami Zayn against Adrian Neville, probably at the December show. And we've got another month of Ascension beatdowns on Itami, like I said, until we get you-know-who. So right now it just feels like we're in a holding pattern. ProWrestlingTees.com is the new home for Sound Off shirts and apparel. Get your official Solomonster Sounds Off logo t-shirt and other assorted designs like the new Eat Sleep Sound Off Repeat shirt, which sounds an awful lot like a typical week for me. And I know it is for some of you guys as well. Now you can show your support for the podcast wherever you go by buying a shirt. Hell, buy two of them. Pro Wrestling Tees accepts PayPal as payment and ships internationally, all over the world. The more shirts we sell, the more designs we'll be able to offer in the future, but we can only do that with your help. Be one of the first 25 people to buy a shirt, and you'll get a shout-out right here on the Sound Off. Visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff to go directly to our new store. That's ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. This is a big weekend for TNA, Bound for Glory, which has already taken place. I'm actually going to have spoilers on that in a few minutes. But it's also noteworthy and a historic weekend, really, for TNA for a very different reason. And I tweeted this out and put this on Facebook yesterday, and that is because TNA has now officially existed longer than WCW. They have outlasted World Championship Wrestling. Somehow, some way, WCW was officially founded on October 11, 1988. Originally, it was under the name Universal Wrestling Corporation. Shortly thereafter, they changed it to World Championship Wrestling. They didn't have their first show under the WCW banner until the beginning of November, but I'm going by the date that the actual organization was formed. So if we go by that October 11th, 1988 date for WCW, and we go by May of 2002, not June of 02, which is when TNA first had its actual show, but the organization officially formed in May, they have now surpassed WCW, and it's incredible to think. And there's a lot of similarities, obviously, in that WCW went down the tubes because of mismanagement and a variety of different reasons, but that was chief among them. And mismanagement has pretty much been the name of the game for TNA almost since day one. Now, the big difference between WCW and TNA is that WCW legitimately at one point was the number one wrestling promotion in the world. They had overtaken WWE, they were kicking ass in the ratings, and their influence on not just the Monday Night Wars, but really the wrestling business in general, is still felt to this very day. Because all of the things that Nitro was doing to be hip and cool and fresh and to lure viewers away from Raw is stuff that Raw and Vince McMahon had to compete with. They had to change. They had to adapt to keep up with the competition, and eventually they ended up overtaking their competition and literally buying them out. But I think were it not for WCW and Eric Bischoff giving Vince McMahon a run for his money and giving him a real kick in the ass, I don't know that Vince would have been motivated to make the changes that he ended up making, and who knows where we would be today. And the format of Raw and the format of all these wrestling shows now, and this may not be such a good thing, this is one of those for better or worse, this may be for worse, the format of the shows now still follows the same format that they kind of morphed into during the Monday Night Wars. So it's all about ratings. Nothing else matters, right? That was the name of the game with Bischoff and WCW. How many pay-per-views did they neglect because they wanted to pop a big rating on Nitro? Put Bill Goldberg and Hulk Hogan on Nitro 6 days before Bash at the Beach. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's a memorable moment, and they were in the Georgia Dome, 40,000 people. But you go from having Goldberg versus Hogan on Nitro 6 days later, now Goldberg is not in the main event, but he is your champion defending against Kurt Hennig. All due respect to Mr. Perfect, that's not really how it's done. So a lot of those things have carried over, and to this day, it's all about ratings. We have these quick segments, you know, people have short attention spans, they don't let anything breathe, they don't focus very rarely on anything long term. So we're still feeling the effects of that Monday Night War period even to this day. TNA has never had any sort of influence on, major influence on WWE. WWE will on occasion copy stuff from TNA. I know people make fun of TNA a lot because they've copied off WWE. God knows they've copied off WWE. Sometimes concurrently as their own storylines are going on, they will copy WWE. But it's not like it, you know, look, it works both ways, okay? But you can't tell me that TNA has had a major influence on WWE and the way they do business the way the WCW did. TNA has never had the impact that WCW did. At no point has TNA ever been competitive to WWE. Have they threatened to overtake WWE or at least give them enough competition to where Vince feels the heat and feels the need to improve his own product? That's one of the things that makes me so angry about TNA. They've had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. The talent they've had on their roster has never been the issue. The issue has always been that they just do things ass backwards. And they do a lot of the little things they do wrong. And it's maddening. And if they did have their head on straight and they did know what they were doing and they had an owner who knew what she was doing, who had a wrestling mind and didn't go into it cold, thinking she knew everything, then maybe we'd be in a position right now where at least Vince McMahon would feel somewhat threatened by TNA and he would have an incentive to make his shows better. What we see now on Monday nights is a product of not having any competition. Because I can guarantee you right now, if there were a WCW around today with an Eric Bischoff and a blank checkbook, okay, Raw would not be the show that we have to sit through every single Monday night. We would be watching a show that was very different than the one we're watching today. TNA could have been that alternative. They weren't. So yeah, they've been around longer than WCW now, over 12 and a half years almost. It's incredible in a lot of ways that they've survived that long, and who knows what the future holds, right? This right now is the most, I think, in jeopardy they've probably ever been of going away, even though I think they'll find another TV home and they'll be around for a while. But who knows? They're going to be off Spike TV in 2 months, 3 months, just under 3 months, I guess. So they better have an ace up their sleeve, or there may not be a TNA. TNA may not live to year number 13. But somehow they've made it this far, and that's to their credit. I don't know how they've done it, but they've done it. And Ring of Honor is not too far behind, because Ring of Honor formed in June of 2002, or maybe that's when they had their first show as well. So credit to Ring of Honor as well, because they've undergone some management changes over the years and some ownership changes, some roster changes. But they're still around, too. And arguably, they probably put out a better product than the other two so-called big companies right now. I bet if you were to watch a Ring of Honor show, you'd probably be less pissed off by it than you would watching Raw or Impact on some weeks. Thankfully, Impact has been better of late. Certainly better than Raw most weeks. It's just been very sad to watch, especially since they moved back to Pennsylvania. This was the second week in a row we've had a show from Bethlehem that was just incredibly depressing to watch. Barely anybody in the audience, barely a peep from the crowd for most segments. Bobby Roode came out asking once again for one more match with Lashley. Instead, he got MVP and Kenny King. It ended with MVP saying that if Bobby Roode can beat himself and Kenny King in a handicap match tonight, then he would get his rematch with Lashley. But if he couldn't win by pinfall or submission, he couldn't pin them both in that match, he would never again get a shot at the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. another stipulation that nobody buys into. Bobby Roode must feel the same way, since he went and didn't really hesitate. He accepted the challenge because he knows it's all bullshit. Madison Rayne beat Taryn Terrell and Angelina Love in a three-way to earn a future shot at the Knockouts title. Rayne pinned Taryn by hooking the tights. After the match, when confronted by Taryn, Rayne acted like she did nothing wrong and had no idea why she was so upset. Could have sworn Madison Rayne was a babyface. She must be going to the same babyface school that AJ Lee went to. Havoc came out after the match and laid out Taryn. Madison bailed. James Storm and the Great Sonata beat Low-Ki and Tigre Uno. This was okay. Manic kept interfering on behalf of Storm and Sonata. Sonata spit mist in Tigre Uno's eyes, and then he stumbled backwards into a last call super kick for the pin. Bram beat Sam Shaw in a hardcore match. Not going to lie, I fell asleep during this match. This was a bad week for me. I averaged probably 3 or 4 hours of sleep every single night. I'm not even sure why. I mean, part of it was work on various podcast-related stuff, but there were other things also, and I got a new iPhone. I was busy setting that up, and that, you know, supposedly the iPhone is idiot-proof, and it's supposed to be the easiest thing in the world to set up, and that's not the case. There's always problems that one runs into, so you start setting up your phone at 9 o'clock at night, figuring you'll be done in an hour or two, and then you turn around, and it's 2:45, and you're just pissed at the world. So anyway, it all caught up to me, and I dozed off, and it doesn't help. I don't drink coffee. I don't drink caffeine. I think coffee is gross, but I found myself sitting there watching a Bram versus Sam Shaw match, and my body just started to shut down on me. I did snap out of it to see Bram get the win using his turnbuckle wrench weapon. Brittany came out after the match. She was caressing Sam Shaw's head. In the very next segment, Bobby Roode said he has not been able to sleep since he lost to Lashley back on September 17th. And all I could think is, I know the feeling, dude. I know the feeling. He said he was ready for MVP and Kenny King, and in fact he was. He beat MVP with the schoolboy after MVP missed the drive-by. And per the rules, he then had to pin Kenny King to get the title shot. Roode caught King with the Roode bomb. Lashley ran in for the DQ. He nailed Bobby Roode with a weak-looking spear. It was so weak, my grandmother, if she was still alive, would have taken it and gotten right back up and laughed at him. That's how weak this thing looked. So now we're left to wonder whether Bobby Roode gets the title shot, because technically he never did pin Kenny King per the rules of the match. So does that mean Roode can never again fight for the title? Luckily, I read the spoilers, so I don't have to spend the next week agonizing over this question. I could save all my agonizing for Raw on Monday nights. Up next, we had Ethan Carter III in the ring calling out Rockstar Spud. He again bullied him around, slapped him a couple of times, until Spud finally stood up for himself, and he said he's not a loser, and he slapped EC3 right across the face. It got one of the biggest pops in the entire show. EC3 said he admired Spud's guts, and then he informed him that he was fired. Now, if you were interested in seeing Spud's reaction, or the reaction of the 200 people in attendance, then you're shit out of luck, because they immediately cut away to a package on Full Metal Mayhem. And when I say they cut away, I don't mean that Mike Tenay and Taz moved on from what we all just saw in the very emotionless way they sometimes do, and they threw it to a video package on the main event. He literally said, "You're fired," to Spud. He rubbed his cheek for about 5 seconds, and they cut away. It's maybe my biggest pet peeve about Impact as a TV show. The instant cutaways that don't leave any time for you to process what you've just seen. Or it just makes it seem unimportant. I mean, this irritated me like you have no idea. And I know it's a minor thing. It shouldn't have bothered me that much, but it did. It just irked me. It wasn't a bad segment at all, but the ending was just terrible. Backstage, Kurt Angle told MVP, Kenny King, and Lashley that despite what happened, Bobby Roode will, in fact, have another shot at the World Championship. Why do they even bother with these stupid stipulations when nobody buys into them anyway? When you can't even adhere to the storyline in the next segment? Like, it didn't even take them a week. The same fucking show, they already dismissed the stipulation. You know? It's like, what's the point? Why do you even bother with stupid stuff like that? Then it was time for the main event. Full Metal Mayhem for the TNA World Tag Team titles, the Wolves, the Hardys, and Team 3D. I can guarantee you will not see a match better than this on the pay-per-view tonight that they're making you pay $50 for. And you got this for free 4 days before. Excellent match. One spot after another of can you top this? I'm kind of numb to all these matches by now, but, I mean, they left it all on the line out there. Just killed each other to make this something people would remember for some time to come. Too many spots to recap. I'm not going to go move by move, blow by blow. But the sickest spot to me was probably Bully Ray powerbombing Davey Richards onto a piece of the guardrail that had been laid out across the steel steps and the ring apron and kind of formed a bridge. That looked like it totally sucked. I hated the way, though, I have to say this. Again, maybe a nitpick, but I hated the way Davey Richards sold this. He doesn't sell pain. He just stares off into the distance. I don't know why. It really bothered me. You know, if I got powerbombed onto a guardrail, I mean, that's going to hurt. You're going to see that pained expression on my face. You'll probably hear me screaming like a little bitch. But there he is. He's just laying there looking off into the stars in the sky. So anyway, the announcers also made a little bit of a faux pas here. They failed to call a 3D early in the match, executed by Eddie Edwards and Bully Ray, two members of the opposing team. Bully caught, I want to say it was Matt Hardy for a 3D, not with his partner D-Von, but with Eddie Edwards instead. And neither Mike Tenay nor Taz bothered to acknowledge it. I mean, how does something like that happen? These guys are in studio, you know, in post-production, adding in the commentary. This guy just nailed his tag team finisher in the first, like, 2 minutes of the match, and they completely ignore it. So I thought that was dumb. Jeff Hardy, credit to him, he nailed possibly the best Whisper in the Wind Swanton combo I've ever seen from him. Usually the Whisper in the Wind is pretty sloppy. It's a little hit or miss, literally. Sometimes he completely misses the other guy. He nailed this one dead on, and then he just killed Bully with a Swanton, landed right on top of him. Everybody was just on their A-game here. People falling through tables, off ladders. Major bump at the end where Jeff Hardy was on top of a giant ladder in the ring, got tipped over, and Hardy splattered on top of Bully Ray, who was laid out on top of two tables on the outside. So they crashed and burned. The Wolves grabbed the belts. They get the win. They are still the TNA Tag Team Champions. The mission here was to put them over as the best tag team in the world. That's why the Dudleys and the Hardys were in there with them. For one night at least, I don't feel like getting into the spoilers again here for the coming weeks, but for one night, they succeeded. Awesome job all around by all guys involved. Kudos to all six guys. Great match. That's how you end a pay-per-view, let alone an episode of Impact. Not with a Dixie Carter talking segment. They got it right for once. After the match, Bully Ray went on Twitter and said, "Despite not winning tonight, me and @testified D-Von have decided to go after one of our other favorite sets of tag team belts. Stay tuned." And my first thought was, he's talking about the IWGP tag team titles in New Japan. They held those belts twice before. Everyone else in TNA is going to New Japan these days, so why not them? You know, they take any more TNA guys over there, they may have to rename themselves TNA. They got Alex Shelley, Doc Gallows, the Young Bucks, who I think were Generation Me in TNA, AJ Styles, Jeff Jarrett, who were part of the Bullet Club. And judging by what happened at Bound for Glory, which has already taken place as I am recording this, took place earlier today in Japan, remember the time zone difference, I think New Japan probably is the likeliest destination for Bully and D-Von. The pay-per-view is airing on tape delay tonight, so if you do not want to know what happens at Bound for Glory, and you are listening to this in the next few hours, skip this next part. You have been warned. Here are the spoilers for Bound for Glory. This is TNA's biggest show of the year. And from the photos, looked like they had a pretty good attendance. I think Corken Hall fits about 2,000 people. Wrestle1 did all the promotion for it, so not surprising that the building would be packed, or nearly packed. I would hope they're able to pack the place. It only fits 2,000 people. It's their supposedly biggest show of the year. Interesting also, they reverted back to the normal four-sided ring for the show. I assume that's just because the Wrestle1 guys don't have any experience wrestling in a six-sided ring. So for one night, we're back to the traditional ring. We had Jiro Kuroshio and Yusuke Kodama beating Andy Wu and El Hijo del Pantera. Minoru Tanaka beat Matic. EC3 beat Ryota Hama. MVP pinned Kazuma Sakamoto. Samoa Joe retained his X Division title that he technically no longer even holds. Beating Kaz Hayashi and Low Ki, he forced Low Ki to tap out in the Coquina Clutch. Team 3D beat Abyss and Tommy Dreamer in a hardcore match, and after the match was over, Team 3D issued a challenge saying they wanted to fight the Bullet Club, which I'm sure made everybody there very happy since New Japan has nothing to do with this at all, and they're throwing down a challenge to somebody in a different promotion. The TNA Knockouts title on the line, Havoc beat Velvet Sky, again a champion who, well, I don't want to get into more spoilers here, but anyway, Havoc wins. And the main event was the great Muta and Yoshihiro Tajiri beating the great Sonata and James Storm. That was your main event. Muta and Tajiri beating Sonata and Storm. When Muta pinned Sonata with the Shining Wizard, Manic came out, and they started double-teaming Tajiri and Muta until Team 3D came out to make the save. And I believe that's how the show goes off the air. That's it. If they can get 10,000 people to buy that show tonight, then they should be doing cartwheels in the street. I would be stunned. I would be stunned if they get 10,000 people to order this pay-per-view. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster, @gmail.com. You can also send MP3 audio questions as an attachment. Please include your name and where you are from whenever you write in. Jorge from Los Angeles. What are your thoughts on Cesaro winning the Intercontinental title at Hell in a Cell and unifying the U.S. title at Survivor Series, then losing it at TLC because of Paul Heyman? This would set up the angle and match with Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble. Well, that's, again, that's the match I pitched last week. I pitched an idea to do Cesaro and Lesnar for the title on the undercard at the Royal Rumble. For people who think it's a weaker match because why is Cesaro getting a world title shot? The idea is that they would start now building him up for that championship match. You've got the past history with Heyman they can play off of. And because the Royal Rumble pay-per-view is sold on the Rumble match itself, you can afford to do a slightly weaker title match on the undercard. So to me, it makes total sense. And the hope coming out of it is that even in defeat, Cesaro will look strong. He'll be over as a babyface. And you'll have, a number two or three babyface solidly under John Cena and Dean Ambrose. And hopefully by then you get back Bryan, you get back Roman Reigns, and maybe come January they'll have a nice top five solid babyface roster. So that was my idea. I pitched it last week. So I want to talk a little bit about this. I got Jorge's email, and I started going over things in my head. And I said, I want to use this on the show because I want to really lay things out here. You know, a lot of times we talk in general terms about, well, you know, what WWE is doing sucks. They don't know what they're doing. They should push this guy or that guy. But, you know, not all the time do I take time to really lay out the plan, to lay out the blueprint of how I would do it. And I thought Jorge's idea of having Cesaro, who is in a feud now for the Intercontinental title with Dolph Ziggler, having him win the title, maybe unify the belt, I thought that was an interesting little twist to the whole thing. So I wanted to take things a step further. Even if there is an interaction with Paul Heyman before the pay-per-view to set that up, to set that Rumble match up, I don't see why Paul Heyman would care to cost Cesaro the Intercontinental title. That's the flaw, I think, in Jorge's plan here. You know, I mean, why? It doesn't make sense that Heyman would even give a shit. Here's what I would do. I'm going to take things one step further. Here's what I would do. You know I want to see Cesaro and Lesnar for the title at the Rumble. That's been established. How about this? How about Cesaro wins the Intercontinental title from Dolph Ziggler at Hell in a Cell? Then he meets Sheamus in a unification match at Survivor Series. We can get back to that feud. I think that could be freaking amazing if they give them time to go out there and have a match like the one they had at Night of Champions. So to go back briefly to the Sheamus-Cesaro feud, it might feel like, oh, they're going back to that again, but I wouldn't mind that at all. I think we can get one more great match out of it. Those two guys work well together. They're stiff. They beat the shit out of each other. And you have one guy with the U.S. title. You have one guy with the Intercontinental title. Now you have a match that actually has some meaning. You have a match now that has some purpose. The winner of this match will unify the belts and will be the unified Intercontinental champion. So now Cesaro wins. He's the unified champion. And then instead of Heyman costing him the title for no apparent reason, maybe have Paul Heyman try to get back with Cesaro again. Now that he's, you know, he's got gold, he seems to be on a roll, the dude is doing well for himself. Heyman's a leech. He wants to jump back on the Cesaro bandwagon. I mean, Heyman calls himself an advocate, right? He's like an agent. That's exactly what he is. He's a leech. He wants to latch back on to Cesaro. Cesaro very politely says, Paul, you know I'll always be a Paul Heyman guy, but I don't need you right now. I'm doing real well on my own. And this doesn't sit well with Paul Heyman. It actually makes Heyman look bad because here's a guy he had under his tutelage who's now doing better without him. Kind of kills Heyman's credibility. Makes Paul look bad. So then, if you do it that way at least, you've got a valid reason to have Heyman cost him the title if you want to do that at TLC. But here's another way you could go with it. And this would serve to also make the Intercontinental title mean something. God forbid they should do that. I know I'm not making any sense when I talk like this. I mean, what's wrong with me? How dare I even suggest such a thing? Why not let him unify it? You could even do the same deal with him turning down Heyman's advances like I just talked about. But instead of Heyman costing him the title, they hype a major announcement on an episode of Raw from Cesaro, who comes out and challenges Lesnar to a match for the WWE Championship. Cesaro says, you know, I've already unified two titles, why not one more? And he sees it more of as a, you know, like a friendly challenge, nothing against Paul. But Heyman, of course, feels betrayed. And that's how you turn Cesaro babyface. That's the catalyst to flipping him to the babyface side. And now you've got a champion versus champion match for Brock's belt at the Royal Rumble, not for the Intercontinental title, obviously, but just having the Intercontinental champion in there being competitive with Brock Lesnar, even when he loses, he's going to come out of it looking like a bigger star than he was going in. And you can get away with it on the Rumble pay-per-view because, again, it's not about the title match, it's about the Rumble match. You don't need to have the strongest championship match on that show. You can get away with having what people may perceive to be a weaker title match. Now, I'm not one of those people. I would love to see Cesaro Brock on any show. To me, it's not a weak title match at all. I'm sick to death of seeing the same people in the ring over and over again. Brock and Cesaro is a fresh match. I think it would be a great match. I heartily endorse it for any pay-per-view. But some people may not feel the same way. Some people may say, oh, this guy's a jobber. I don't know what people see in him, or he's been booked like a loser. That's not a real title match worthy of a pay-per-view. I disagree, but again, some people may feel that way. I mean, I don't know about you. I am sick to death of John Cena and Brock Lesnar at this point. After Brock killed him at SummerSlam, you knew he couldn't go any higher than that. The only other place for it to go is Cena getting his win back, and I have no interest whatsoever in seeing that. There's already some rumors that maybe the Rumble match will be Cena-Brock 3. Why? Why? Why do we need to see that match again? You had a chance to do it at Hell in a Cell. That would have been the time to do it. You didn't do it. So that ship has sailed, as far as I'm concerned. Get somebody new in there with Brock and get him primed for Mania. Whether it's Roman Reigns or Dean Ambrose or Daniel Bryan, I'd be fine with any of those three in the Mania main event with Brock. I'd prefer Ambrose or Bryan, but again, that's just me. But there you go. That's two different ways you could go with the Cesaro-Lesnar program heading into the Royal Rumble. I came up with that in 5 minutes. Not even. You think WWE is putting that much thought into this? Sean from Toronto, with the announcement of the Royal Rumble having 40 men, and again, we don't have that confirmed, that's just a rumor at this point, but anyway, would you book the Rumble match around Brock Lesnar where every man cuts promos on, headlining against him at WrestleMania, wanting to be the one to beat the one? They could even have guys come face-to-face with Brock leading up to the pay-per-view and sign contracts for their name to appear in the Rumble match. Seeing a few guys face-to-face with Lesnar could gauge who the fans are interested in seeing him wrestle. For example, Batista, Roman Reigns, etc. Would you book the Rumble around Lesnar? I think that's also a great idea. And you could do that with the Cesaro idea. I mean, they're two separate things. What he's saying, I think, anyway, what Sean is saying, is to make the Rumble unique this year, because Brock is this unbeatable force. He ended the streak. Over 20 years in the making, he ended the streak. He killed John Cena at SummerSlam the way that nobody else has done ever before. He's a unique performer. You have to keep him unique. Well, what if people in the Rumble, and this is kind of similar to what they did back in the day, they would have people cut promos about what it means to them to be in the Rumble, and that's kind of old school. But having people actually cut promos on Brock Lesnar, it's similar to an idea that some of you guys pitched to me a few years ago about should the Royal Rumble, instead of it being for a title shot, should it be about who gets the right to face The Undertaker and possibly break the streak at WrestleMania? And I don't recall being a big fan of that idea, but it was creative, it was unique, it would have been different, you know. But I don't like how it would have put the streak above the title. That's probably why I didn't want to do it. But this is similar in that you're taking this guy, Brock Lesnar, you're making it all about him, only in this case he's the champion. And people want to win the Rumble and get a title shot at WrestleMania, but they also want to be the one to beat the one. And yeah, you can have segments on Raw in the build-up to the Rumble where Batista confronts him, Sheamus confronts him, guys that have not gone nose-to-nose, face-to-face with this guy before. And let's see how the fans react to it. Maybe the fans react big if Bad News Barrett one night comes out interrupting Brock Lesnar and goes face-to-face with him, and the people start sharing, you know, let's go Barrett or whatever. I'm not saying change all of your WrestleMania plans and put, you know, Wade Barrett in the main event, but it could be an interesting way to gauge what people, the fans, might like to see Brock in the ring with, and who you might want to give a push to. It might be a good way to gauge that, too. What people are the fans into? Oh, this guy, okay, the fans really reacted well to him, so let's earmark him for a push in the next, you know, couple of months or something. You know, because that's really how you're supposed to gauge these things. You know, who are the people into? They say it's all about the audience. The audience can make or break a career. Maybe it's time they start paying a little more attention to who the people want to see and not who they want you to see. Alex Castillo, Hulk Hogan has been pushing for a match against John Cena at WrestleMania 31. I personally want to see it as it would be Hulk Hogan's retirement match, but I know there's some concern for Hogan's back. Should a Hulk Hogan versus John Cena match take place at next year's WrestleMania? Why or why not? No. I do not want to see Hulk Hogan against John Cena, nor do I think the match should happen. I think the match should have happened in 2009. That was the plan. The plan was to do Hogan versus Cena at WrestleMania 25. That was the big silver anniversary. They had Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker in what turned out to be, in my opinion, the greatest match in WrestleMania history. Imagine a double main event of Michaels versus Undertaker and a main event of John Cena versus Hulk Hogan. See, though, that would have been two big matches worthy of the 25th anniversary of WrestleMania. Triple H, Randy Orton was always a dead main event to me. It was even deader as a match. It wasn't a bad match, but as a WrestleMania main event, it sucked. And the fans didn't care about it. And the fans were dead, coming off Michaels and Undertaker. I think the only way they would not have been so dead is if they would have had Cena versus Hogan. That would have been a big marquee match. Hogan had some back issues back then. There was like a botched surgery that he had. I think he filed a lawsuit against the clinic or something. And the match never happened. He hasn't wrestled the match in a WWE ring, I don't think, since his SummerSlam match with Orton in 2006. That's a long time. And you watch Hogan now. Look, I mean, he's moving around a little bit better than he was the last time we saw him on Impact. But he ain't moving around that well. He can barely move. He can't do the leg drop. So you can't even have the big leg drop tease or the big leg drop finish at the end of the match. You know, he could throw some punches. People can run into his fist. That's great for an angle if they want to do something like they did with Hogan and Hassan at WrestleMania 21. But to do a match, you know, it's too late. Too little, too late. Hogan's too broken down. You can't do it. Who even knows if he would pass a physical? So, no, that's a match I would have liked to have seen years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, but it's too late. It's too late. Anthony from Philadelphia, since we are coming off SmackDown 15, which I was in attendance for, I had a couple of questions about the Blue Brand. Why was there no follow-up to Shawn Michaels superkicking The Rock on the very first SmackDown, as this was the closest we ever came to HBK and Rock having any type of match? Also, why does WWE never acknowledge the original SmackDown pilot from April of 1999, which I remember being a pretty solid show? It doesn't matter how solid the show was, it was a pilot. That's why they don't talk about it. SmackDown officially came on the air full-time in August of 99, and that's how they acknowledge it. It's a pilot episode. Pilot episodes don't get talked about very often. As for Michaels and Rock, it was because Michaels wasn't wrestling. I mean, it was 1999. You know, he was only a few months removed from back surgery. Because I think what happened is Michaels wrestled Austin at WrestleMania 14. He went away for several months. I was actually at the Raw show when he made his return in July. He came out and did commentary. And then I think after that he became the commissioner. He was on TV, but I don't think he actually. I think he was rehabbing his back, hoping it would get better, but it didn't. And I think he went in for back surgery in early '99. I could be wrong. I didn't read his book. Maybe he talked about it in his book. That's my understanding. But the point is, he wasn't that far removed from major back surgery. I think in '99, he and WWE were still of the opinion that he was done. I don't know that Michaels thought at that point he was ever going to make a comeback. So what were you really building towards? You know, you could do some angles, you could do some back and forth promos with Michaels and Rock, but what are you building to? If there's no match, you're not building to anything. So that's the biggest reason why the match never happened after they did the angle. As far as why they didn't do the match before that, Rock didn't want to work with them. I think it's pretty well documented. Rock was not a fan of Shawn Michaels. That goes back to when Michaels and Marty Jannetty came in, I want to say to Hawaii, to work for his family. His family was promoting wrestling shows, and I guess they were a bunch of dicks, and he never forgot that. And also with the stuff with Bret Hart, you know, Bret Hart took Rock under his belt when Rock first came in, so Bret in some ways was a mentor to him, and I think in that whole Bret versus Shawn deal, Rock took Bret's side and just generally wasn't a fan of Shawn Michaels. It probably only validated what he already thought about the guy. He just didn't want to work with him. I'm sure Shawn would have loved to have worked with him, but Rock didn't want to work with him. And I think now, you know, that's all behind them now. They're fine. You know, there's no animosity there. But that's one of those dream matches we missed out on. I think it would have been really good with both guys in their prime, Rock against Shawn Michaels, and we never got to see it. Tom from Latvia. A few days back, I took some time to watch some Attitude Era footage, specifically the odd love triangle between Triple H, Stephanie McMahon, and Kurt Angle. What happened to that feud? Just kind of seemed to end out of nowhere. I agree with you 100%, and I think we all know why that was. Look, when you do angles on television, where you have a couple, like a real-life couple, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, and you break them up, one of them turns on the other, and they end up aligned with a different wrestler. Unfortunately, art tends to imitate life more often than not. There's a lot of marriages that have been broken up by wrestling angles that were done. And I'm sure Triple H knew that, and Triple H was not happy continuing this feud any further. And I remember hearing that one of the plans was to have Stephanie turn and actually, because she had to make a choice, right? Well, her choice would have been Kurt Angle, and that Triple H may have talked his way out of that and got that squashed, and he beat Kurt. And the feud just ended out of nowhere, and they moved on. Now, Kurt ended up winning the championship a month later, and that's a whole other story, a famous folklore story with Triple H piping up in one of the production meetings about how, you know, we shouldn't put the belt on Kurt, he's too small, it's not believable. And then Jerry Briscoe, who was in the meeting, you know, piping up and saying, oh yeah? Well, why don't we put you and Kurt together in a shoot, and we'll see who the tougher guy is. And that shut Triple H up real quick. And they did put the belt on Angle, and he held it for a few months. But I agree. I mean, it ended out of nowhere, and I think there's a lot of different ways they could have gone with it, including one way that I had always heard that would have put Stephanie with Kurt, at least for a period of time. And that got squashed real quick. Robinson from Columbus, Ohio. I was wondering, I hear a lot of people talk about Owen Hart in different conversations from his matches with Bret. Great road trip stories, even ribs he played on other wrestlers. But why is it that he never really made it? He was a tag team champion and an intercontinental champion, but never WWE champion. Why did he play second fiddle? I've addressed this before. I'm a big Owen Hart fan. I had a chance to meet Owen Hart less than a year before he died. I was watching the pay-per-view when he did die, and it was very... It was very depressing when that happened. He seemed overall like a good person. Very well liked. Very good wrestler. One of the best wrestlers they had. And it wasn't just Bret. You know, when Owen did the turn, and he was one of the few things worth watching in WWF at that time, 1994, 1995, 95. I mean, my God. But the one thing about 95, I will say, as a positive, as awful as that year was, guys like Owen Hart were keeping the show together. I mean, he was going out there having matches with the 1-2-3 Kid and Hakushi. You had a lot of really talented guys on that roster. And Owen could go in there and have a great match with almost anybody. But I never saw Owen Hart as being WWE Championship material, except when he was feuding with Brett in 94, had they put the title on Owen, let's say in that SummerSlam match, the rematch from WrestleMania 10, had Owen won the title, I would have been okay with that. I would have bought into it, and then you have Brett chase him and eventually win the belt back. The time to put the title on Owen Hart that would have made sense was when he was doing the sibling rivalry feud with Brett. At no point after that did I ever see Owen Hart as being WWE Championship material. Some guys, they're just not. And I'm not saying he couldn't have gone out there and have great matches. I never saw him as being the champion. I never saw him as being the guy. His promos weren't that good. Promo ability back then wasn't as, I guess, important as it would be today. I just throw that out there as another point. Then again, Bret Hart was never a great promo either. So I don't think anybody's doubting his in-ring ability, but, you know, some guys, you just look at them and they're just not championship material. So it's not that he couldn't have done it. I just don't think he would have been that successful as the champion. And I think, if anything, he would have been a really quick one-and-done type of thing. I can't imagine him having, like, a lengthy title run. It's just not in the cards for some guys. Some guys just are not meant to be the world champion, and I would put Owen Hart in that category. David from Malaysia. Imagine if Wade Barrett goes to UFC tomorrow and has a good run for 2 or 3 years, maybe even holds the heavyweight championship, has great title defenses, still puts on good shows even after he loses it. Then he returns to WWE. Will he be getting a serious push like Brock Lesnar if that happens? I don't think he'd be back to doing the bad news nonsense, but would he be a real main eventer? I would hope so. If WWE plays its cards right, he would be. But then again, if Wade Barrett can go to UFC and help pop a million buys on pay-per-view the way Brock did, if he could be a pay-per-view draw the way Brock Lesnar was, then absolutely. Wade comes back, instant main eventer. Big business. That's what Brock was. Brock was big business. Brock was probably the biggest thing on pay-per-view. You think about Mike Tyson back in the day, and now it's Floyd Mayweather. But aside from those two, Brock Lesnar would probably be on that list at number 3 in terms of pay-per-view draws over the last, 5, 10 years? 15 years? I don't know how De La Hoya was when he was boxing. I'm sure De La Hoya was probably a big draw too. But Brock is in the conversation. Brock is up there with those guys. Look, if Wade Barrett goes and he pops numbers like that, then absolutely. I don't think Wade Barrett, though, would go to UFC and be the kind of player that Brock was in terms of business. I know Brock is just, he's different. He's a beast. You know, Barrett's a big dude, but he's no Brock Lesnar. But if he did, then absolutely. You would be foolish not to bring him back and push him to the moon. Because maybe some of that would rub off on you. Maybe some of that success he had in UFC would hopefully rub off on WWE. It did to some extent with Brock. Brock never came close to drawing pay-per-view numbers there like he did in UFC. But there was a noticeable spike, I think, especially on those first few shows that Brock appeared on. Probably less so today. He's more removed from UFC now than he was back then. But I think the one thing we could agree on is that Wade Barrett, he's out hurt. He'll be back hopefully in about 2 months. Even before then, he was starting to gain some momentum. He has been one of the criminally underutilized guys on that roster. And I think he can play the role of babyface, like badass babyface. He can play the role of heel. He's good either way. I see him as being a babyface when he first comes back. But he's been underutilized. There's a lot of guys you can say that about on the roster, and Wade Barrett would be near the top of that list. So hopefully, when he comes back, they have a battle plan for him, and they push the guy, and they put him in a meaningful storyline, and just let him get over with the crowd organically like he was doing before. Because I think he could be that breakout star, or one of the breakout stars for them, in 2015. I really do think so, but we have to have faith that they'll do something with him, and that's a whole other issue. Gavin from Newcastle, England. You recently talked about the unsuccessful run of Bret Hart in WCW and how in many respects they dropped the ball with him. Had history gone differently and Shawn Michaels had been the one to jump to WCW, do you think he would have been more successful? I think he probably would have been, as he had more friends in high places like Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. He also had more left in the tank than Bret did at that stage in his career, since he was pre-bad back caused by the casket match. I think that had Shawn Michaels been the one to go to WCW back then instead of Bret Hart, it would have ended up as a disaster for Shawn Michaels in WCW. I don't see that working. There may have been an initial bump. He may have had a couple of big matches. But I think before long, it would have been a complete and total disaster. He was all drugged up back then. I'm sure a lot of those guys were. But he was not in a good place. He was difficult to work with. And, you know, Hall and Nash, maybe Nash to some extent. I mean, Hall was already having problems at that point. I'm not sure how much stroke that, you know, he really had. So, yeah, I mean, he would have been protected to some degree, but it wouldn't have changed the fact that Hulk Hogan was still the top dog. So don't think for a second that, you know, when Bret Hart came in, Hogan wasn't keeping him at bay, wasn't keeping him at arm's length. After a few months, Bret had turned heel. He joined the NWO. They squandered whatever they may have had coming off Montreal, one of the hottest incidents in wrestling history. And now they have this guy, the uncrowned, unofficial world champion from the other organization, and they completely botched the whole thing. And then they turned him heel, and he was just another guy. He was another dude in the black and white, subservient to Hulk Hogan. Of course, before long, I think there was a match on Nitro, he was teaming up in tag team matches with Hulk Hogan. Hogan knew exactly what he was doing. He knew what he had to do to protect his spot. Had Shawn Michaels been the one to come in, he probably would have felt even more threatened. And believe you me, before long, it would have been Shawn Michaels teaming up in tag matches with Hulk Hogan. And I'm sure Shawn would have had, you know, a problem with that. Why is this guy getting pushed and not me? You know, and I should be the one going over and not him. Believe me, there would have been a ton of problems. And WCW would not have known what to do with Shawn Michaels. They wouldn't have known what to do with him. You really think he would have gone there and he would have ended up being the top guy? Michaels could have wrestled circles around every single one of those guys. He would have been the best in-ring performer they had, and they still would have found a way to botch the whole thing. So, yes, he did have friends there. He may have been happier there, but I think in the end, he was much better off staying where he was, working for Vince McMahon, and I think in a lot of ways it may have saved his life. Vince McMahon supported him. He kept him employed. He kept a paycheck coming into him. Michaels got hurt. He went away. And it was during that downtime from his injury that he hooked up with Whisper of the Nitro Girls, who I think Kevin Nash set him up with her. I think she was a born-again Christian at that time. And Michaels was still having some substance abuse issues. You know, he was supposed to come back and wrestle in 2001 and showed up in no condition to perform. There was a lot of bad blood even with him and Triple H. They had a falling out. And in the end, Michaels found Jesus or whatever. He found God and credits his wife for that. And they seem to be one big happy family now. And Michaels put that all behind him. He came back. He had a whole second half of his career and seemingly was a lot easier to work with. And he wasn't walking around saying, I won't lay down for anybody. It was like a different person. Had he gone to WCW? Who knows if any of that would have happened? You think Eric Bischoff and them gave a shit, you know? You know, Shawn's doing his thing. Everybody was probably all pilled up back then. So being around those guys, being around other guys that were doing the same thing, it's not like Triple H, you know, he was his babysitter in WWE, was sucking down pills and sticking needles in his arm. You know, the one thing about Triple H was he's always been a clean guy. He doesn't drink. He didn't do hard drugs. I mean, who knows what other kind of chemicals maybe he was putting in his body later on. I can't really comment on that. But I do think that being in WWE may have saved his life because he was going down a bad path and WCW was the Wild West back then. Guys were doing whatever the hell they wanted to do. Everybody had their own agenda. There was no organization. At least in WWE, you knew the buck stopped with Vince McMahon. In WCW, you didn't know who to go to. At first, it was Bischoff. Then Bischoff got ousted. Then Vince Russo came in to write and they brought in this guy. They brought in that guy. They brought Bischoff back. That lasted all of 3 months. I just think it would have ended up being a disaster had Shawn gone to WCW, for him and for the company. And finally here, this comes from James. Do you think TNA would have a chance of competing with WWE as closely as WCW did in its heyday if The Rock, Stone Cold, and John Cena all jumped ship, they signed CM Punk, and brought back Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, and Sting all at the same time? Sure! Why don't we throw in Bruno Sammartino and the corpse of the Macho Man, Randy Savage? And we'll throw Randy Orton in there. We'll take all three S.H.I.E.L.D. guys. Let's send them over. Why don't we just rename the whole company WWE? How about we do that? That's the answer to the question. If TNA just renames itself WWE, It may have a shot. All right, let's get to the Sound Off throwback here because we are running way behind. But I do have a throwback I want to get to. It is by popular request. It was a special emergency episode of the Sound Off. Maybe the first I ever did, certainly one of the first, that I recorded on a Tuesday. Tuesday, October 11th, 2011. So it was 3 years ago this weekend. Sound Off episode 184 was recorded. This was the night after the angle where all of the WWE superstars staged a walkout on the new COO, Triple H, where everybody on the roster, including CM Punk, who had been red hot over the summer, was made to look completely inferior as compared to the almighty Triple H. A boring show with bad comedy and angles that make no sense. Sound familiar? At least they're consistent. So let's take you back to this little snippet from a very volatile episode. I don't remember ever being as angry as I was when I sat down to record this emergency Sound Off, episode 184, from 3 years ago this weekend.
It's time to go back in time.
This was easily the worst Raw of the entire year. What a shit show this was on Monday night. Not surprising, considering that Vince McMahon, much like he did last week, apparently ordered several rewrites of the show up until just a few hours before they actually went on the air. Nobody knows what the hell they're doing in this company these days. Even with a pretty good opening couple of minutes, I will say, on this show was absolutely atrocious, not only because it was so boring, but just how badly damaging it was to the company overall. I mean, the effects of this show are going to be felt for a long time to come. And the three biggest things to take away from this show are, number one, Triple H is the man. Number two, everyone else on Raw sucks and is inferior. And number three, the so-called, quote, rebel, CM Punk, is officially dead as a doornail. It's the first time I've done a review here where virtually the entire show is in the ugly category. I mean, to say that somebody beat this show over the head with an ugly stick would be an understatement. It got beaten over the head with a flaming ugly stick wrapped in barbed wire. We had Triple H come to the ring. He said that he wasn't going to quit no matter what. All the wrestlers were protesting in the parking lot, so he said he would strip down to his underwear and wrestle a broomstick for the next 2 hours if he had to, and that the broomstick would give him a better match than most of the guys in the parking lot. I guess we shouldn't be surprised, considering this is the same man who on TV earlier this year claimed that there was no competition left for him in the locker room. And we got CM Punk who came out. Then they went and did comedy, with Triple H putting his arm around Punk, Punk asking if he could wear Hunter's blazer. Triple H tells him, sure you can. Now keep in mind, it was no more than a month ago that CM Punk was insulting the man's wife. Remember that? So mad did this get Triple H back then that he flat out said that it was no longer about business with Punk. It was personal. And here we are after Triple H beat him in the middle of the ring, of course without retribution, just a few weeks later, and they're like bosom buddies in the middle of the ring. You see, this is why nobody gives a fuck anymore about wrestling. Punk was the only guy, he was the one guy, that you could not afford to fuck up because he made people believe. Actually believe that he was different. He was special. He was anti-establishment. And now look at him. Look at him wearing Triple H's blazer, which looked to be about three sizes too big for Punk. He looked like a little kid wearing his father's jacket. Looks like Stephanie McMahon is going to have to go shopping this weekend to look for a new Gucci purse, because the one that she has now can't possibly hold both her husband's balls and Punk's balls at the same time.
Yeah, that was a bad show, and 184, like I said, one of the more angry episodes of the Sound Off you'll ever listen to. You can go listen to the whole thing in the archives on thesolomonster.com. Right now, it's time for this week's sad tweet, and we actually have multiple winners this week. First, we had a fan who sent a tweet to Lance Storm, WWE alumni. They sent Lance a tweet saying, I wish you were in WWE 2K15, to which Lance Storm replied, me too, money. And Zack Ryder couldn't help himself. At Zack Ryder had a pipe in and said, I wish I was in too, ha ha. Ha ha indeed, Zack. And that would have been fine as the winner for this week's sad tweet, but Then Dixie Carter lost her mind on Friday. She posted a whole bunch of stupid stuff on her Twitter. But one thing that she posted that came back to bite her, and she apologized for it, and she took the tweet down. She tweeted out something that said, "The storm is coming. Hashtag bound for glory." And she included an image of a weather map with James Storm's face over this monster typhoon storm. And there's a legitimate typhoon, a killer typhoon, that is actually headed for, or maybe it's already hit, Japan. And I think it's supposed to hit the mainland like later this week. So there's this killer storm that's about to hit Japan, and she thinks it's a good idea to post that photo. I mean, even I put together a funny photo once that I put on my own Twitter page of James Storm drinking a beer bottle standing in front of a weather map. But it was making fun of the fact that Impact may well end up on the Weather Channel if they can't find a TV home. There's a big difference between posting something like that and posting what she did. And the thing that just is amazing to me is that this woman has a public relations background. She used to run her own PR company right before she took over as the president of TNA. She should know better than to post something like that on social media. So, like I said, sure enough, she took it down. She apologized for it. But man, that was in poor taste, to say the least. So that was a sad tweet for this week. A couple of different choices there. And you can always recommend to me your own sad tweet if you think you got a winner for me to use this week. Feel free to tweet it to me at Solomonster or shoot me an email. Let me know. You can follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. We'll take you directly to my profile page. We have a closed discussion group on Facebook that's growing each and every week. We've got a great community of guys, some really good people in there. So please join our family. We also have a fan page on Facebook that gets neglected quite a bit. I would really appreciate it if you can give us a like on that page. And subscribe to us on YouTube, because in the next few weeks, I'm planning on getting up some new content on the YouTube channel, some sound off extras, some reviews that are long overdue, so you'll want to be subscribed, so when a new video goes up, you will be the first to be notified. And of course, keep streaming the show online, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, you can support the show in a multitude of different ways, including via Audible Trial, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. We're trying to rack up some more numbers between now and the end of the year. So keep telling friends and family. Again, it doesn't cost them a thing. So if you think they may enjoy getting a free audio book, I mean, for God's sakes, who doesn't enjoy getting things for free? It doesn't cost you anything to sign up for a free trial. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You could also make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. Get yourself a shout out. And don't forget our Pro Wrestling Tee store. We now have a whole bunch of shirts in there. I think our store looks the best of the ones that are there, but maybe I'm being a little bit biased. And we got more shirts coming this week, including two designs I think you guys are really going to like. ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster sounds off. Now accepting credit and debit cards, not just PayPal as payment. So head on over there. I am looking forward to the season premiere tonight of The Walking Dead on AMC as I sit here recording this. Show's about 5 hours away or so. And I thought the cliffhanger last season was really good. Again, I don't read the comics. I just feel it would be better to go into things fresh and not know everything that's going to happen. I know they deviate a little bit from the comics, but sometimes they don't. I'd rather just keep watching the show and just read the comics back later on. That's how I approach things. So I have no idea where this is going other than the fact that it looks as though they have been trapped by a bunch of cannibals. That's just me figuring things out from the bones that were sitting on the ground in that last episode when we last saw them being herded like cattle. So I am very much looking forward to watching some quality television tonight. I don't know about you guys, but all this wrestling stuff, when you really think about it, we watch a lot of bad television. And I've said before that Monday Night Raw is the worst show on TV, and people say, well, you're exaggerating. Not really, because as long as they insist on comparing themselves to other shows, then they're going to get compared to The Walking Deads and The Breaking Bads of the world and Mad Men and all that kind of stuff. And when you really think about it, when you put Raw on the same platform with any of those other shows, there's no comparison. And they're shooting themselves in the foot by comparing themselves to every other show on television. But if they insist on doing it, then I'm going to keep saying it. Raw's the worst show on television. The Walking Dead, on the other hand, is one of the best. And I'm looking forward to the season premiere tonight. And I'd love to say that I would do some reviews on the Sound Off, but I think the timing just doesn't work out. I mean, the show airs on Sunday night, so being that my show drops on Sundays, you know, I'd be talking about something that, I mean, I know that to some extent that's the case with Raw, but it would be even worse with The Walking Dead. I'd be talking about a show that was like 2 weeks old, and it's better to just follow me on Twitter. I'm sure I'll be live tweeting thoughts during the show. So, very much looking forward to that. And I think that about does it for episode 349. I have gone way over time here, one of the longer episodes of the Sound Off I've ever done. I know you guys like that, so it's not a complete loss. And believe it or not, when we're back next weekend, it's going to be episode 350. 350 episodes of this podcast as we approach our seven-year anniversary next month, now less than a month away. Those are some pretty big milestones to hit, and I have you guys to thank for that. You keep tuning in, I'll keep cranking them out. Keep supporting the podcast. Thank you very much. Until next week, be well, stay safe, and we will see you then for a brand new episode. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
Jonathan writes in, Sheamus and Dean Ambrose don't defend their U.S. title for weeks and how the titles mean shit. Let me school you, son. There's a big difference now, today, between the world title and the secondary titles. WWE has done a horrendous job. So they lose and they lose and they lose, and soon enough, people look at them as losers who happen to carry around a belt. That's not how you make your title seem important. Your champion should look strong. So now that I shot down your argument there, if Brock comes back and defends the title at Survivor Series, and then again at the Rumble, and again at Mania, the world will not end. Business will not die. But I guarantee you, those Brock Lesnar title defenses are going to be must-see TV when they happen. So, eat your sour grapes and just relax.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters sound off.